Great Britain and Japan, two nations once defined by order and cultural continuity, are now unraveling under the same globalist forces of mass demographic change.
Police emergency.
Yeah, we've just been attacked by someone racially.
In Britain, years of anti-racism indoctrination have crippled policing, producing a two-tier justice system.
Your officers assisted in that man's death.
That protects minority feelings over public safety.
In fact, Henry told officers that he could not breathe 9 times. He told them he had been stabbed 4 times. The response from one officer was, "I don't think you have, mate."
He was actually treated in a way that meant an accusation of a racial slur was treated more seriously than an act of murder. What does he say? "I can't breathe." Familiar words? Remember career criminal George Floyd, who died in appalling circumstances in Midwest America a few years ago. Remember the reaction to that and the way the police behaved. Within a few days, Keir Starmer was taking the knee. Black Lives Matter exploded all over the country. Churchill's statue was defaced. The cenotaph was vandalized. And yet, what has the public reaction been from our leaders and politicians? And indeed, to be frank, much of the media to this. Silence. Absolute silence. Proof, if ever there was any, that we're living in a two-tier culture in this country where the rights and privileges of white people matter less than those of ethnic minorities.
When we have police cars with pride flags on it, which is a politicized movement, we know that the police, who are supposed to be impartial, are often anything but. They are driven by an ideology, a Marxist, cultural Marxist ideology, that is not right, that is not good, and it's against you, and we're seeing two-tier policing, we're seeing two-tier justice, two-tier politics, and the people of Britain have had enough of it.
The outrage has exploded as Nigel Farage, Parliament, and even John Cleese expose how religious exemptions shield violence while native citizens face the consequences.
But no matter the pain we feel, there is no justification for more violence and disorder. The attacks directed towards police officers in Southampton last night were disgraceful and completely unacceptable. This is a time for serious work, not rage. And let me be clear, we will ensure anyone found engaging in disorder meets the full force of the law, as we have done before.
Under the Criminal Justice Act 1988 and Offensive Weapons Act 2019, carrying a bladed weapon in public carries up to 4 years in prison for ordinary Brits, yet Sikhs receive a statutory religious defense for the kirpan, allowing public carry even as prosecutors admitted Digwa chose a larger 21-centimeter blade beyond his compliant neck kirpan. France, Denmark, Sweden, Italy, and the UAE have banned public kirpan carry outright with Sikh compliance. But UK authorities cling to the exemption, effectively arming one group while disarming the native people with no way to defend themselves. Further east, Japan, long a holdout against this chaos through post-war restrictions and the 1952 Immigration Control Act, now faces its own opening salvo. 10 ancient temples and shrines, including one from 807 AD and a World Heritage Site, have been torched in the first 5 months of 2026 alone, despite automation over cheap labor and strong public opposition to large-scale immigration. Japan's quiet visa expansions and cultural arson signal the same globalist pressure hell-bent on eroding identity. Britain surrendered to the script and got two-tier chaos. Japan resisted and still watches its soul set ablaze. Proof that dilution of a people's history, safety, and cohesion is not progress. It's engineered collapse. John Bowne reporting for the Alex Jones Network at alexjoneslive.com.
Now in the 21st century, it's time to stand up and realize that we should not allow ourselves to be crammed into this rat maze. We should not submit to dehumanization. The 21st century is going to be a new century. Not the century of slavery, not the century of lies and issues with no significance, and classism and statism and all the rest of the modes of control. It's going to be the age of humankind standing up for something pure, something right.
I have sworn upon the altar of God eternal hostility against every form of tyranny over the mind of man.
I want freedom! That's what I want! And that's what Jake should want!
You're listening to Alex Jones.
The truth is out there in front of you, but they lay out this buffet of lies. I'm sick of it, and I'm not going to take a bite out of it!
AlexJonesLive.com. Tomorrow's news today.
You're watching The War Room with your host, Harrison Smith. Watch it live right now on X.com.
Annihilate.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to War Room Live. I'm your host, Harrison Smith, coming to you live this Wednesday, the 3rd of June, 2026. We got a lot of stories to cover today. Just so many videos, it's going to be impossible to get to all of them. But I got a lot of them because we got to do a little compare and contrast. Not only do I have to show you things like the statements from British authorities about the death of Henry Novak and the ensuing outrage about it, but we also got to go back in time and compare those videos to what they were saying during the Southport riots or during the terror attack a month ago in Golders Green, which wasn't actually a terror attack, or during the George Floyd riots, because I know it's not exactly, you know, breaking news. This isn't something you don't know already. But yeah, the two-tier thing is unavoidable, and the outrage is perfectly understandable, and we're going to get very much into what's going on in the UK with Henry Novak. We'll actually be joined, the death of Henry Novak, that is. We'll be joined by Jack Hadfield, who a lot of the footage that you're seeing from the riots yesterday were captured by him. He's going to come on and give us his sort of first-person view of what's going on. And I'm going to put the question to him, how is this going to be different? Because we saw the Southport riots. We saw the outrage, the once again very justifiable fury from the English people who saw, in that case, their little girls murdered by the state, essentially, by one of the state's little agents that had been brought over. And at the time, it was like, okay, either this protest series snowballs into like actually overthrowing the government, that's sort of one option, and then the only other option is they fizzle out, they get shut down, the leaders get arrested, and everybody involved gets systematically rounded up. And that's essentially what happened after the Southport riots. And I wonder what's going to be different about this one, because it's not like the people in power don't know what the people of the UK want. It's not like the protests are over some impossible ask. They want basic safety. They want to be treated like first-class citizens in their homeland. It's not that complicated, but the power structure steadfastly refuses to budge an inch. And you really can't come to any conclusion other than it's on purpose and they want to destroy the United Kingdom. And I really don't know what other conclusion you could come to looking at the way all of this has been handled. But we also have a lot of other stuff to talk about. We've got a lot of political nonsense to get into. Big hearings today on Capitol Hill with Scott Bessent and Marco Rubio. Todd Blanch was up there yesterday. And there's somebody else, Mark Wayne Mullen, also being grilled today. And there's some interesting and fiery backs and forths on Capitol Hill today. We'll show you those videos. I'm also going to be getting into what the hell the Kushners are doing in Albania, of all places. And I went down a little bit of a rabbit hole on this one, and we'll get into that because it has been revealed now that Jared Kushner and Ivanka Trump basically trying to purchase an island in Albania off the Albanian coast, and the Albanians are not very happy with it. And now the funds for the construction have been frozen because of a corruption investigation into Jared Kushner and his business partner. But it turns out this is a very long time coming. And again, I'll explain the rabbit hole that I went down to get to my conclusions as to what exactly is going on in Albania. But I guess we will begin with Henry Nowak, since we'll be joined very shortly this hour by Jack Hadfield. And we've got some interesting back and forths going on. And you know what? I don't have numbers on these, so I'm not sure if we'll be able to go to these so quickly. But this is from Paul Weston at P. Westoff on X. Starmer's response is very dangerous. I'm getting message after message from normally placid people stating the only way Britain can be saved is by violent insurrection and the execution of traitors. And, yeah, it's heating up, folks. The parliament is getting a little hot, and Nigel Farage, is helping to lead the charge, but he's really abandoned his post to Rupert Lowe. What really they should be combining forces. The problem is reform is, controlled opposition is what you call it. But let's go to this video. 3 minutes long from Lee Harris, Paul Weston retweeted. This is it's part of the question time in the parliamentary system where they get to put questions to the prime minister. And here's Farage lodging his complaints. Let's watch.
Nigel Farage. Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Following the horrendous circumstances of Henry Nowak's death, can I urge the prime minister to consider this? It is now clear to growing millions in this country that we're living under two-tier policing. The instructions that are given to police officers from police bosses are clear and written down in ink. It says you must treat different ethnic groups in different ways. That, apart from the upset and the anger at the circumstances of his death, the anger that you saw spilling out in Southampton last night.
Condemn the violence.
Which is in danger of getting considerably worse. If the public lose trust.
Condemn it.
If the public lose trust in being treated fairly by the police, can he take some action, end this divisive practice of two-tier policing, and make sure that all British citizens are treated the same?
Mr. Speaker, I don't believe there's two-tier policing in this country. I'm really shocked that he pretends to have respect for Henry's family and then acts in this way. They are a grieving family.
Mr. Blatch, please, it's a very important question. I want to hear the Prime Minister. If you want to carry on, go outside, please, Prime Minister.
Grieving family have asked us not to respond in the way that the leader of reform has responded. They've asked us not to. They have lost their son in the most appalling circumstances. They make a simple plea of us as human beings to please not exploit that. That is their plea to us. We all need to reflect on those words of Henry's father. My response, and the response of others, to be fair, has been focused on the lessons to be learned so we can deliver justice. His response has been to appeal for rage. Rage. That's his response to a father who's lost his son and asked for that not to happen. Exploiting this tragedy to create grievance and division would be wrong in any circumstances, but to do it when the family are expressly saying, please don't, is unforgivable. It shows exactly who he is.
Excuse me. So, again, you know, it's like, what do I even have to say? What do I even have to say? The outrage from Keir Starmer is performative. The only thing they have to hang their hat on, the only claim they can even make at this point, is you're disrespecting the family's, request. Basically, the family came out and said, please don't, make this a big political thing. Here's the problem, though. One, again, the family can say what they want. We're concerned about our children. We're concerned about our future. We don't want to be that father into the future. This concerns everybody. And yes, even people here in America, because again, the attack on the UK is a universal and ubiquitous attack on every Western nation. But specifically for the people of the UK, they have a vested interest in making sure that the problems that caused this are fixed. And if the, parents don't want it to be a source of outrage and division, well, it is. So I don't know what else to tell you about that. Of course, all of this is just completely and utterly and totally inverted. And all of the people now, so concerned about not politicizing violence themselves, all to a man politicized violence that had absolutely nothing to do with their country, even let alone, particular aspects of their political reality. And of course, I've got all the records. Oh, we'll go through all of them today. And you don't have to wonder. You don't have to take my word for it. I've got all of it laid out here. For one thing, let's look at the way the protests yesterday were covered. BBC News UK, same account here. When George Floyd riots racked London, causing massive destruction sort of across the board, tearing down statues and, destroying things, hurting people. It says 27 police officers injured during largely peaceful anti-racism protest in London. Now, they were just injured. Right? This is the passive voice. 27 police officers got themselves injured during the largely peaceful anti-racism protest in London. Meanwhile, police pelted with missiles at Henry Nowak protest. Okay, so when 27 police are injured and the city is burned and priceless artifacts are thrown into the river, it's all passive voice. It's all the police got themselves injured at this lovely and mostly peaceful anti-racism protest. When it's Henry Nowak, it's police pelted with missiles at Henry Nowak protest. Not White Lives Matter protest, not, during vigil for murdered white guy. But that's just, one little sample of the way that the media is covering this. And that, in a way, encapsulates the two-tier society that they have. I mean, forget two-tier policing. It's a two-tier society. There's not a single person in Britain. This is from Sam CKX on X. He says, there's not a single person in Britain who doesn't agree that the death of Henry Nowak was a tragedy. And the way the police handled it was absolutely disgraceful. There's only one political party, however, that wants to take that family's pain and politicize it to their own benefit. So what does this even mean? What you're saying is everyone in Britain recognizes and is horrified at the death of Henry Nowak, but there's only one political party that actually wants to take proactive steps to prevent it from happening again, and that makes them the bad guys. Everybody sees the danger. Everybody sees how bad things are. Everybody's outraged and horrified at what happened, but you're a bad person if you try to change things to guarantee it doesn't happen into the future. Madness, pure, unrelenting madness, obviously. Please recall the UK authorities, by the way, have a dedicated unit called RICU whose sole occupation is intimidating the families of politically sensitive murder victims to shut up and put out pre-written stuff like the script that was read by Henry Nowak's parents. And we talked about this yesterday. I talked about the Office of Community Relations here in the United States, which does the same thing. And I said, obviously they have something similar. They have an equivalent in the UK where they go in any case of racial sensitivity. They go and pressure the parents to read the script, basically calling for calm. So then they can then turn around and say, you're the bad one. You're now hurting the parents by opposing the thing that killed their son. Kind of ridiculous, if you ask me. That tweet I just read was from was a response to Dan Hodges saying, number of people asked me to comment on the Henry Nowak case. His father said, we do not want his death to be used to create further division, hatred, or tension. if you can't respect his wishes, you're scum. That's what I think. But again, it is literally a word-for-word verbatim script that they read. I mean, it's like perform, you know, it's a form they fill out. It's a template that they apply. It's not sincere. It's something that they're pressured to do by the government, who then turns around and uses it as an excuse to silence people. Now, when it comes to the question of, oh yeah, so RICU, this office, it's the equivalent of our Office of Community Relations, was covered in The Guardian in 2016. The Guardian unraveled the secretive workings behind a campaign to stop UK Muslims from falling prey to the Islamic State. The shadowy Whitehall unit, the heart of the British government's covert strategic communications campaign, was inspired by clandestine Cold War propaganda program. While the Cold War offensive targeted communism, trade unionists, and newspapers in developing countries, the current operations are aimed at Muslims both in Britain and the Middle East. The British-based element of the campaign and part of the Prevent Counter-Radicalization program and run by the Home Office Research Information and Communications Unit, or RICU, R-I-C-U, RICU officials, dislike the word propaganda. They prefer the term strategic communications. The extraordinary ambitions of these communications are set out in RICU documents seen by The Guardian. Strategic communication aims at effect behavioral and attitudinal change, says one paper. For almost 2 years, RICU's focus has been on Islamic State, whose own online propaganda has proven powerful. ISIS is calculated to be posting an average of 18 messages a day, many of them showing not violence but flowers, forests, and flowing streams to emphasize the natural beauty of the territory under its control. But yeah, essentially, you can look into it yourself. This is the office that is the propaganda office of the UK, and one of the things that they engage in is approaching people who are victims of crimes and get them to play down or discredit the racial aspects of those crimes only and exclusively when it's white people that are the victims. When it comes to the claims that the police are racist or that there's two-tier policing, a claim that Keir Starmer just outright rejected in no uncertain terms, are, of course, absolutely real and written down in the training manuals and handbooks and information the police receive. And, of course, the comments from the police are constantly reinforcing this idea. When you read the College of Policing guidance from March 25th this year, it boils down to everything is racial. We must fix the country by treating people differently, although, of course, we'll never end racism, which is our original sin. This garbage should never have gotten beyond the world of deranged academic theory. It's now undeniably a blueprint for getting white people killed. So it's anti-racist commitment. The Police Service of England and Wales is committed to anti-racism and racial equity. Anti-racism and racial equity. Our commitment to anti-racism means we're taking a stand against racism in all its forms. I mean, you know this language. We've heard it 10 billion times before. It's not exactly a surprise. We also have a story from The Times UK. Officers from force behind NOAC arrests pressured by diversity course. A staff survey found 1 in 7 of the officers in the area around where Novak lived, 1 in 7 of them felt controlled and pressured to adopt certain ideas in the sessions run for Hampshire and Isle of Wight constabulary. A number of officers in the force responsible for the arrest of Henry Novak felt controlled and pressured to feel certain ways after receiving mandatory diversity training, a survey has revealed. The course is taught in Hampshire and Isle of Wight constabulary officers and staff about racism, unconscious bias, privilege, and the importance of being an ally. The staff survey found 1 in 7 officers and staff, 15%, had felt controlled and pressured to adopt certain ideas in the sessions, and the same number thought mistakes could have been held against me. A fifth feared being rejected for saying the wrong thing. The revelations are likely to provoke fresh questions about the role of equality and diversity guidelines in the actions of police officers. After video that showed officers in the same force handcuffing Novak, 18, for alleged racial abuse while he lay dying from stab wounds. And so it's not a question. It's not a debate as to whether the training is going on, whether it's having an effect. Like, it absolutely is, and this is one of the negative consequences of it, which, like so many things over the last several years, is political. The attack is political. The attack was a racist attack against a white kid, almost certainly motivated by the constant stream of anti-white incitement that you get on the media. The person who stabbed him is an immigrant, and of course, immigration into UK is the number one political topic discussed there. You also have the fact that the people who did it, the murderer himself, the knife man, knew that he could call the kid racist in order to get away with his crime, or at least he thought he could. This is a political attack. This was a political attack. This attack only occurred because of the political situation in the UK right now. So you're not politicizing anything. You are appropriately addressing the underlying cause of the attack. Meanwhile, to politicize something is to take something that is totally apolitical and then couch it as if it's political, which, of course, Keir Starmer was engaged in to the maximum degree when it came to things like the attack on the Jewish people in Golders Green, which was not an anti-Semitic attack in any way. The guy stabbed a Muslim first, and then he stabbed two other random people. And then Keir Starmer gave speech after speech after speech about how the British government had an undying loyalty to the Jewish people and how they had to do everything they possibly could to provide them everything they could possibly need to keep themselves safe. An outpouring of concern politicizing an attack that was literally just an insane person stabbing random people with no concern as to who they were. That's politicizing an attack. To address the political causes to an attack is not politicizing anything. It is political. Just like when illegal immigrants get attack people here in America, that's a political situation because it is the outcome of political decisions that were made. Henry Novak's case is, in fact, the same. Matthew Stalden on X says, Farage, of course, has form. He did it after the Southport murders. He's doing it again after the murder of Henry Novak. He looks to divide and destroy rather than unite and build. Carl Wilkinson responds to this with, I think, the key phrase we all need to understand and start adopting and utilizing. He says, we have reached Soviet levels of gaslighting. A man is murdered. And yet somehow the real problem is that people are angry about it. Children are gang raped. And somehow the real problem is that people keep mentioning it and dividing communities. This is moral inversion. That's the phrase. That's the word. That's what's happening constantly to us all of the time. The person that's dividing the community is the murderer, not the people responding to the murderer. People dividing the community are the people telling you, you have to accept the murder because otherwise you're making people feel unwelcome. You people are the bad ones. You people are the ones causing the problems. It's moral inversion to then blame the victims for the chaos that you've created. He says crime divides community. Institutional failure divides communities. Cover-ups, euphemisms, cowardice, and elite contempt divide communities. This is community coming together. Coming together to beat up the cops. It's a beautiful thing, actually. And so when we get back, we're going to go, we're going to talk to Jack Hadfield, who was there on the ground, and you'll see his watermark there on a lot of the videos that we've been showing and that you're seeing all over the internet. So we're going to talk to him and, you know, get the on the ground first person view. But we're going to stick to this topic because I'm going to go through later in the show the comparison between an attack that occurred about 2 months ago and this one. And it's not just obvious, you know, the difference between the reactions. It's infuriating and offensive and enlightening as to who's really pulling the strings behind the scenes. We'll be back on the other side with Jack Hadfield. Please share this link. Share it at AJ and Live on X. I'm at Harrison H. Smith on X, AlexJonesLive.com. Of course, we're on Rumble, rumble.com/TheWarRoomLive. That's rumble.com/TheWarRoomLive. Share those links right now. We'll be back with Jack Hadfield on the other side. Stay with us.
So it's real simple. If you want to keep this broadcast on the air, if you want to see us hire more hosts, more reporters, and expand, go to thealexjonesstore.com and get the very best supplements, widest selection of Patriot apparel, and so much cool stuff. The problem is the really cool products they get, like the Faraday bags and the wallets and the knives. It's all great. They sell out so quick and they can't get the supply of them. But I want to thank you all for your support. So they give away an amazing American super vehicle, usually an off-road truck or SUV or sports car, every month. But every month of the last week, there is a special time where every purchase you get gets put into the sweepstakes 100 times, every dollar you spend. And most winners do it during this last week. And then you get $10,000 per vehicle when you win it. Nobody's ever won two vehicles at once. It's over 12 vehicles they're giving away now, or 14 vehicles. So this week until Friday at midnight, it's by law, it's all sweepstakes company. every order you make, every dollar you spend at theofficestore.com, you put in 100X to win the souped-up custom H1 Hummer and the 2026 Dodge Charger Scat Pack, plus $20,000 cash, or $10,000 each if you just won one vehicle. I can't wait till somebody wins both. Every dollar spent, 100X entries at thealexjonesstore.com. And that's a bigly thing that, you know, they're our sponsor, main funder. I was never really a sweepstakes guy, but now I like it because listeners love it. And, you know, we fly the winners in. We're building a bigger studio. As soon as that's done, we'll have winners in again. So take action on that right now at thealexjonesstore.com. But let me just say this again. All I want to do is steer you right. I would not sell you something that doesn't work, because I want you to like me in the show, and I also want you to want to get it again. I use the analogy all the time. If I owned a restaurant, it would have real quality, delicious, wide selection, great atmosphere, great service, reasonable price. I want to have the restaurant that has lines around the block every time. I don't want to, you know, you don't need Google to know who's got a good restaurant when you're even some small town middle of nowhere. I'll be driving along with family. Hey, let's search reviews. This town coming up. I go, I'm not looking at a review. Human intelligence. I'm going to pull into town and I'll drive through the town and say, okay, that place has 5 cars at it. That has 20. That has a line out the door. If I'm not in a big hurry, I'd rather go to the one with the line out the door. If I'm in a hurry, let's go to the one that's full at least. And then I get this incredible meal. You can buy fake Google reviews. I don't go off that. I go off the reality. And if you don't get our ultramethylene blue or ultramethylene red or Irish CMOS or Shilajit or bovine colostrum or our T3 iodine is the best, you are insane. You're not just getting the very best products that'll blow you away. You're funding an organization proven to piss off tyrants and change the world for the better. Take action now at thealexjonesstore.com. There's a big mega sale one day going right now. 40% off methylene red, atomic defense moon booster, methylene blue tincture, methylene blue gummies, MK Ultra brain booster, Warcry smelling salts, 35% off zeolite detox, spike protein, heavy metal detox, zeolite tincture, creatine powder, the very best, CMOS capsules, methylene blue caps, up to 30% off iodine tincture, CMOS gummies, Shilajit caps and gummies, ultimate chill and energy, and so much more. And that funds the second American revolution worldwide. So you have until Friday at midnight central to get in to win either or both of the vehicles, 100 times entries, but that's just a fun thing you do. You're missing out if you don't get the incredible products. And by the way, I was like, what are smelling salts for? I was ignorant. They're like, oh, they're a best seller, sir. We're selling. It's a big seller now. Because I guess if you're going to lift weights or you want to wake up without coffee, just smell this. My God, you're awake. You're a truck driver or whatever, you know. Don't have to drink too much coffee or whatever. Just get this. Warcry smelling salts. It's all there at thealexjonesstore.com.
Welcome back. We are connecting right now with Jack Hadfield. He was on the ground at the protest in the UK over the death of Henry Novak yesterday. We're going to get his on-the-ground first-person view of what occurred there and what he saw and how he thinks it'll go this time around, as it is just the latest in a series of protests against the immigration and the horrifying consequences to the people of the UK. As we bring him in, I do want to ask you to go to thealexjonesstore.com. Thealexjonesstore.com is the only way that you can really support, since the only way that we really get support. If you like what we do here, if you think it's valuable to have an outlet like this in existence, it's entirely up to you whether you go to thealexjonesstore.com or not. You don't go, we go away. You go there, we stay around to be a pain in the butt for the globalists and to tell the truth about things despite all of the lies swirling around. Go to thealexjonesstore.com, get yourself some ultramethylene red, ultramethylene blue, Irish CMOS, Shilajit gummies. They're all incredible. They're all extremely low price, and they all directly support the Alex Jones Network, Alex Jones Live, The War Room, and our launch and evolution into the future as we grow and evolve. With that, I'm very happy to welcome my guest, Jack Hadfield. He can be found on X at Jack Hadders. And Jack, once again, we have you to thank for some of the incredible footage that came out from the riots yesterday. Glad to see you're okay. Just how was it? Well, what was the experience like?
Yeah, so what happened yesterday was really we ended up with two different protests. The main protest started outside the Southampton Central Police Station at 6 p.m. I mean, I got there at 5, you know, an hour before, and there are already, you know, hundreds of people gathering. I would have said around 3,000 to 4,000 people, I reckon, turn up to this protest. And this was, you know, one where you had multiple people speaking. Tommy Robinson, obviously Nick Tanconi from UKIP, Kelly J. Keane, from Let Women Speak, and Richard Inman, who's an anti-jihadist, activist. And there was this already sort of bubbling, simmering anger, but as Nigel Farage said, it was cold, pure rage. There wasn't any, anything going back and forth with the police, but there were chants of, you know, scum towards the police, saying that people should be ashamed of themselves for wearing the uniform when they can sort of complicit in the system that led to the death of Henry Novak. And quite frankly, what was most interesting about this is that there were chants of "I can't breathe," which is Henry Novak's last words. Of course, extremely evocative of George Floyd. They would chant that then, and also "racist police off our streets," another slogan you expect to hear at leftist protests. So that was all, you know, pretty peaceful, but there was obviously anger within the crowd. After that protest finished, a good chunk of the protesters then marched around 1.5-2 miles north up to Portswood Police Station, which was just around the corner from where the killing actually took place. And so there was a protest there of, again, a fewer number of people, because obviously a lot of them split off as the march went north through the town. I mean, it was about a 30 to 45 minute walk up hills, so not something to be sniffed at necessarily. And at that point, that's when the police line started forming. You know, people started to be thinking about kettles. There was starting to bottles being thrown, and then because literally the road where it happened was literally just around the corner from this second police station. That's the point where you've seen the footage of the bins being thrown, the riot police engaging, and at that point, the riot police then moving further back down the road to get to the original police lines. And then that's where, at the later in the evening, you had the further clashes with the protesters. But this was, then really the people who engaged in the violence was a fraction already of a fraction of the initial protest. And I think it's right to actually declare that this was a mostly peaceful protest, if you're basing it by the numbers of the people who turned out at 6 p.m. And of course, this is the phrase that the establishment used when talking about the George Floyd riots in 2020, which was actually burning things down. People were killed as a result of this, police and civilians. But this, of course, is now being portrayed just like Southport, just like the Asylum Hotel protest that I've covered just last year. It's being portrayed, as you would expect, far-right, violent thugs. The politicians are, of course, condemning this rather than focusing on condemning the anti-white hatred of the police that, again, led to certainly, if not the death directly consequentially, the terrible mistreatment at the end of Henry's life.
Yeah, and of course we've seen this over and over, as you point out. I mean, the Southport riots, the Asylum Hotel riots that you covered and came on with us at that time. To me, this feels a little bit different, and maybe I'm just seeing this myself, but it coinciding with the rise of Rupert Lowe and Restore Britain and the, you know, expose about the grooming gangs that's coming along. Nigel Farage taking a very strong stance against this, talking about the cold rage it inspires. It seems like at least at the political level, this is being treated differently. Do you think that's true, or am I seeing things here?
Yeah, definitely at the political level. And in terms of the sort of level of violence that you saw there, I think it's fair to say it was certainly less than Southport. Southport, I've described as sort of hot rage. It's fire, and it only burned for, you know, 6 days straight across the country. And then, of course, Starmer came in and arrested everybody.
Right.
And last year, the Asylum Hotel protests were very, very peaceful. There was a couple clashes with the police here and there. But actually, yesterday evening, there was, you know, once they got to the police station, there was sort of a continued amount of time of around 2.5 hours where They would clash with the police. They would stop. The police would move back. They would move back and forth. And it was a sustained level of at least 2 hours of serious disorder going up and down and back and forth of the levels of it. And then it sort of dispersed at the end of the evening. So it was not to the level of Southport where the police vans were, burning and bricks being thrown at mosques. But it was also more than what we saw at the Asylum Hotel protest. You could possibly argue that this is because of the cause. Obviously, Southport, three little girls murdered, you know, by a black guy for seemingly no reason other than that he just hated white people. The Asylum Hotel protests, obviously, then based on sexual assaults and rapes. And again, then this was a murder of a young white man. So maybe you can say on the kind of the outrage scale, perhaps that was sort of in the middle of those two in terms of pulling at the heartstrings of people. But it definitely has changed. I think, you can tell the reaction that's had in the political scene, especially from Reform. I think that's kind of the difference here, in that Restore have been focusing on the arguing to bring back the death penalty and banning the kirpan. Now, the latter of which Reform has also posited, but Reform are primarily going after the police and the anti-racism which is within the police, which of course these anti-racist programs are of course actually anti-white. And you know, Nigel has said white lives matter too, which of course is crazy to imagine that someone who's frankly potentially the next future prime minister of this country coming out with. If you said to somebody that in 2020, you know, I don't think they would have believed your ears.
Right. Well, and that is a difference here, right? Is that at Southport, as brutal and horrific as it was, it didn't have that element of the police being complicit in some way. You could say the immigration, you know, system is complicit. Maybe you could say overall the system is complicit because of how it handles violent crime, especially from minority groups. But in this case, you have the racism of the police in, you know, many people's eyes contributing directly to the death. So do you think that is why this is taken on such a more political character, because the government in a lot of ways is directly implicated here where they weren't in other cases?
Yeah. So actually I would slightly disagree with you there, but you're basically on the right track. You know, what we've seen before when it comes to how the police deal with minorities. Now, the Hampshire police and the National Police had a race action plan, which was brought in place after George Floyd, where they deliberately treat minorities better than they would treat white people, specifically not race blind. You know, and of course, if there's accusations of racism, they have to take this seriously. Now, the police have had sort of these anti-racist policies, you know, since 1998, after the McPherson report following the death of Stephen Lawrence. It was a black man who was killed by a few white people in London, and other racist reports. But so if you look at what's happened previously, it's all been about reducing sort of the impact it has on minority people. Mm. So if you look at what happened at Southport, I think the police were complicit, but in a negative light, in that PREVENT, which is the counter-terrorism, counter-extremism part of the police, this program, Axel Rudikubana was basically sort of taken off of it, or they didn't care about him that much because he was a young black kid. If you look at the Pakistani rape gangs, you know, the police didn't investigate this because they didn't want to be called racist. The Manchester Arena bomber, you know, people didn't want to look into him because he was Muslim. So all of these things where the police are complicit in basically either in letting crimes happen, that sort of letting crimes happen, letting minorities get away with it. Whereas what we've seen now is the exact opposite point of that case, in that the police have actively gone after a white person, assumed the white person is the aggressor, treated him as such, and therefore the last words that he heard is this bleeding out of the ground, where he being read his rights, and when saying he was stabbed, the police officer said, "I don't think you have been, mate." So that is the difference now, what we've seen, the impacts of the anti-racist and therefore anti-white policies of the police, and that's why it's crystallized in such a fashion.
And I'm just thinking about it in comparison to Southport. And again, I don't know if I'm just imagining things, but it does seem to me that with Nigel Farage saying white lives matter, and it seems like Southport didn't have sort of the popular support that this one has. Again, am I seeing that? Do you think that that's accurate just from your discussions of people around you? I mean, it seemed like a lot of people in the UK that I saw during the Southport riots were sort of ready to write them off as hooligans and extremists, that they don't represent us. You know, we'll handle it a better way. Whereas I don't see a lot of that this time. I see a lot of like no, the police are wrong here and there needs to be serious change. I mean, it feels like this could be the catalyst for a much larger, you know, comprehensive change of the way things happen in the UK. Again, am I seeing things? Is it too early to tell? What's your take on that?
Yeah, I think you're right, but I think this probably wouldn't have happened without Southport. I think if you didn't have that initial spark of massive violence, we wouldn't have had the protest last year. We wouldn't have had this protest. You know, the fact that these now spontaneous right-wing protests have sort of cropped up, which have been organized by local people rather than, more right-wing activist groups like the EDL or Britain First in the past. I wrote a piece for Pimlico Journal a couple of months ago on the changing face of right-wing protest. Well worth looking up if you want to do a deep dive on how that has shifted in Britain over recent years. But I think importantly with this, I think you're right in that it will make a change. Again, Reform, which obviously they're leading in the polls now, if they're going to be the next government, they've already claimed, you know, not just to have this kirpan ban, which of course is the supposedly religious weapon that the Sikhs use, and obviously that was used in this instance to murder Henry Novak. They have put forward an Equal Treatment Act in that they'll completely remove all of this anti-racist things from the police, DEI training, all of this. And I think Reform would have looked into looking into all of this DEI stuff within the police, but they wouldn't necessarily have gone so hard and so fast now, you know, if there wasn't this spurring on incident.
Yeah, and again, the two-tier policing has become, you know, an obvious catchphrase that's very accurate. I was reading this today, the moral inversion that's going on. I think that's such a great phrase for what's happening, where your son gets attacked, but you're the bad guy for, you know, complaining about it. Your community gets disrupted, but you're the one causing division if you speak out against it. And it seems like that's not, again, as effective this time. It seems like people are going, no, they have a right to be mad. They're right to be angry. They're right to be outraged by this. And again, the inconsistency between the way the George Floyd rioters were treated. And we got some videos. Let's go to clip 49 here. This was during the Hare Halls riots in Leeds. So this was in 2022. So not even as far back as George Floyd, but a good comparison as to, you know, when the Muslim community is rioting, here's what it looks like. Let's go to clip 49. So here you see, Muslim rioters, no police line to be seen, no riot shields. They actually are there, but they're way off in the distance. There they are, way, way over there, letting the people burn cars, letting the people destroy things, and giving them plenty of room and backing up when they approach. So again, the aggressiveness that we saw yesterday, totally absent when it's the Hare Halls, Hare Hills, I'm sure I pronounce it, but these were the Muslim riots back in 2022. We go to clip 47 here. This was the Black Lives Matter riots in the UK, where the leftists tore down a statue, I believe this is Winston Churchill, and, you know, poured it, you know, threw it into the river. Let's watch clip 47 here. So again, you can see, you know, this is what was going on during Black Lives Matter, and at that time, Keir Starmer was taking a knee. I'm talking about how important it was these riots be allowed to continue. So again, the moral inversion, the inconsistency, the inequality. I guess that's not Churchill. That was that other guy who I guess they said had slaves or something. But who cares, right? Just destroy the public art, and no one's going to stop you. No police to be seen. And they can take their time with it. Takes them a while, but nobody's bothering them, so they can do it. So again, I don't understand how the UK public has been blind to this up to this point, but I don't know how you move forward not recognizing the shocking inconsistencies with the way law is applied there in the UK.
Yeah, I mean, just a quick correction on there. The Hare Hills riots actually took place in 2024, just 2 weeks before Southport. So that's what made the reaction to Southport even more astounding, because only, you know, just as Keir Starmer came in and started arresting everyone who'd been to any right-wing protest who might have just said something silly on social media, it was only 2 weeks before that Muslims were rioting in the streets and the police weren't there. But I think it really was, you know, Southport. I think it probably is quite a big turning point in how people understood politics and reacted to politics, and certainly looked into how the establishment behaves and treats people. It was two-tier care. Don't forget, it was only a month after he was elected prime minister, which was on
ironically, on your guys' Independence Day in 2024, where he then immediately, you know, just a month, less than a month into his tenure, started locking everybody up. Right. Just for daring to come out in the streets. Of course, there was some actual violence, people who probably should actually have been arrested, but lots of people who frankly wouldn't even have come close to that threshold. So I think since then, you know, that's why one reason why Keir Starmer has become so unpopular, because he has become the figurehead of this two-tier treatment. And frankly, you know, having two-tier Keir, having that as a name is quite portentous. If you're going to be known for this double standard, you know, that rhyming doesn't help at all.
Right. Well, and so I guess my concern is, like, how is this going to be different than Southport? Because Southport was so crazy. It was so, like, massive. And I remember at the time going, look, either this snowball keeps rolling downhill, it keeps growing, and there's going to be real systemic change that's going to come from this, or they're going to crack down and they're going to throw everybody involved in prison. And it turned out that's what happened. And of course, we've gone over and over and over, but people don't remember. I mean, they were emptying out the jails of murderers to make room for the people they were sending to jail for posts on Facebook. And they were setting up 24-hour expedited court processes so they could jail the maximum number of people. I mean, they went insane. Is this going to be the same? Are all these, you know, young men who are caught up in the violence, are they just going to be systematically rounded up? I mean, how is this going to be different than Southport? What outcome could emerge from this that wouldn't lead to just another round of crackdowns?
Yeah, so I think you sort of, rather than looking at all of these individually, you do have to sort of think of Southport as the start, and Southport has yet to end. Southport, I think, and then the riots over there set the stage for then the much wider peaceful demonstrations of last year, and then the, you know, what we're probably going to see more of this summer, slightly heightened, you know, that cold rage rather than the hot rage. And, you know, people are being, of course, very more careful what they post on social media. They're being, you know, slightly less obvious with the police on that point, masking up, for example, to protect that. I think, you know, Southport set off this chain of events where now you have, again, in Nigel Farage, you know, who hopefully, touch wood, will win the next general election. These riots and, well, these protests, these people coming out in the street and making their voices heard is directly then influencing, hopefully, the next government in the country in how they will act. So that's how you sort of have to look on the much wider timescale. Southport, obviously, at the time looked like it was just a disaster, but it set up the way that we're dealing with politics now. I still think if we hadn't had those riots, there would have been some political change, but certainly you would have not seen at all the level of this pure street protest, political engagement in a different way outside the ballot box than you have now.
So what do you think would be, I mean, what could the government do now to sort of show that it's taking these complaints seriously? Like if the riots continue, if you were the spokesperson for the rioters and they said, you know, here's the list of demands that we want. I mean, what are those demands? What would you want the government to be doing?
Well, I mean, immediately you just have to admit the fact that two-tier policing exists, the fact that anti-racist things within the police are anti-white. They disproportionately affect the native people of this country, and deliberately so. And you have to admit that the system is set up in that way. But the Labour government just yesterday and in Prime Minister's questions today with Keir Starmer, they completely denied that this was happening. You know, if I were Labour right now, I would be saying, like, yeah, anti-white racism is just as bad as racism against black people, Sikhs, Muslims, whatever. And clearly this is an issue that we need to fix. I mean, Jack Straw, who was a former Labour Home Secretary, who had the McPherson report in 1998, who sort of had the phrase of institutional racism, even he just said either today or yesterday that, oh, actually, this has probably gone a bit too far. So if you're having these former Labour politicians who are admitting this, I think it's frankly a big open goal for the government to not be addressing it in the way that these other people are.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, just the idea that they would reject these claims is so absurd. We literally have the police's own training manual stuff, and it says, I'll read it, quote, producing equality of policing outcomes for people from different ethnic groups by responding to individuals and communities according to their specific needs, circumstances, and experiences, with understanding these will be racialized and with the aim of reducing harm. It does not mean treating everybody the same or being colorblind, parentheses, racial equality. So, I mean, they literally say it's not about being colorblind. It is literally about having two tiers based on race. So the idea that they would reject that is outrageous, because it's literally in the literature. But do the people of Britain know this? I mean, we're getting maybe a distorted view looking at X and being in America. Are the people of Britain aware of all of this going on? I had another picture of a guy who took a picture of the, magazine newspaper stand in the UK today. Not a single headline about Henry Novak, not a single headline about the protest. Do the people of UK even know this is going on?
I'd be surprised about that. I did see a bunch of the papers this morning when I was just on GB News, and they're all talking about Henry Novak.
They are? Okay.
So,
well, good.
I wasn't sure about that, but this is the only news in the country right now, and even sort of more establishment, outlets of sort of writing, like Times Radio, for example, had a colleague of mine on, David Shipley, to talk about, this anti-white racism within the police. You can tell, certainly there's no one who is condemning, who is saying the actions of the police were good. They're all saying it was bad. And, it's just the levels, people are just disagreeing on the levels of where there is this institutional issue, perhaps. I think certainly if you talk to most people, I would say that, everyone agreed this is a terrible, terrible thing to have happened, and that the police were at the very least partly to blame. And this is, frankly, I don't think anyone, even on the left, are going to counteract the narrative that the police did the right thing. Nobody's admitting that. They're just saying, what level of blame are we dealing with here? So if you're already coping that far back, then, you can see how the narrative is already being lost for them.
Yeah, it is. And I think it was Carl Benjamin that pointed out today, they're now the left is now using the phrase, well, all lives matter. And he points out that's an inherently defensive claim, which really shows that sort of the tidal shift has occurred, and sort of the impetus is with the native Britons who just want, their country back. And that's a really beautiful thing. We are so lucky to have somebody like you on the ground capturing this footage. I mean, so many of the videos that we played yesterday had your watermark on them. How can people find you? How can they support you in your all important work, sir?
Yeah, you can find me primarily on X. That's at Jack Hadders. All of my other links are available, jackhadfield.co.uk. I think you also go to buymeacoffee.com/Jack Hadfield if you want to send me a tip or anything. Buymeacoffee.com/Jack Hadders. I forgot my own donation link. It's been a while, but it's in my bio on X.
Bio on X. So there you go. At Jack Hadders, HADDERS. Again, just incredible work. We wouldn't know what was really going on if we didn't have people like Jack Hadfield here on the ground getting the footage for us. So do go support him. Buy him a coffee. He needs one with all the work he's doing. Thank you so much for being with us, sir.
Thanks for having me on.
All right, we'll be right back with the second hour. Don't go anywhere, folks.
Then at midnight, Alex Jones was thrown out and locked out of his InfoWars studio along with his crew after the 8-year-long legal battle trying to shut him down and censor him is coming to a close. And liberal media are celebrating with headlines like this. The lights go out at Alex Jones InfoWars. And InfoWars.com, the domain name, now has a message that just says off air. But these people don't know anything about Alex Jones, because if you just go to alexjoneslive.com, the website looks very similar to the old InfoWars website. And look at there! There is a live feed of his show, the Alex Jones Show, now just not using the InfoWars name, where he is continuing. It hasn't missed a beat! If you go to the Apple App Store and the Android App Store and search for AJN Live, you can download the new Alex Jones Live app, where you can still listen to his show streamed live on your phone. Or you can just find and follow Alex Jones on Twitter, X, where he still has 4.5 million followers, because despite the lawyer's attempts to try to take his personal account, they failed. And you can see there the live icon around his profile photo shows that he is live streaming the show there on repeat 24/7.
There is a war raging for the future of humanity. We have opened a new front at alexjoneslive.com. They thought they could silence us. They thought they could drive us off the air. They failed. We are back, stronger, louder, unbroken. Find the feeds. Hear the broadcast. Share the signal. AlexJonesLive.com. The coordinates of freedom.
If you are receiving this transmission, you are the resistance.
Back, ladies and gentlemen. This is War Room Live. I'm your host, Harrison Smith. We're going to continue to discuss the disparate reaction from the British government over the murder of Henry Novak versus other major events in the recent past. And this, of course, is all part and parcel in the ongoing genocide of the European people that the elite there are just absolutely desperate to keep going no matter what. No matter what it takes, they're going to continue to import immigrants and cover up their crimes. It's just, that's what the purpose of their life is now. Friend of the show, I can't remember, what does he go by? Raw Egg Nationalist, Charles Corningdale, aka Baby Gravy 9 on X, wrote an article for The Spectator about this. We can look into the article a little bit, but here is Raw Egg Nationalist himself at Baby Gravy 9 on X. Talking about his latest for The Spectator about the quote-unquote great replacement. Let's watch.
Well, there's a first time for everything, and this is my first video reaction to one of my own articles. This piece is in The Spectator in the UK, and it's about France's changing demographics and the left-wing, far-left attempt to appropriate and reclaim the term the great replacement. Now, as we know, that term is probably one of the most controversial political terms in the world for the best part of 15, 16 years since it was coined by the French intellectual Renaud Camus in 2010. It's been vehemently denied that the Great Replacement is taking place. It's a far-right conspiracy theory. It's driving extremism and violence. There's no truth to it. Well, guess what? Now the French left, led largely by Jean-Luc Mélenchon of France Insoumise, France Unbowed, which is an interesting name, I think, for a left-wing party, have said, no, actually, you know what, the Great Replacement is happening, and it's a good thing, and it's inevitable, and there's nothing you can do about it. So there's a new study that's just been published by France's premier research institute. I forget the name of it. It eludes me at this present moment. But anyway, they've showed that 34% of the French population now is either an immigrant or from a recent immigrant background. So child or grandchild of immigrants. So a full third of the French population at least is now of an immigrant background. It's difficult in France to quantify the effects of immigration because the constitution forbids the collection of ethnic and racial statistics. So although it's been obvious, you know, that demographic change is taking place as rapidly in France as anywhere else in Europe or the Western world for that matter, it's been very hard to quantify it because of what's often actually criticized as a deliberate blindness on the part of the government. Well, now we know. It's one-third of the French population.
One-third of the French population is now foreign-born or from immediately, you know, foreign parentage. And again, this is something that they've tried to cover up for a very long time. The article can be found at The Spectator, France's Hidden Immigration Reality, Charles Cornish Dale. He quotes Renaud Camus, France's most controversial living intellectual, when he says, a people was there, stable, occupying the same territory for 15 or 20 centuries, and suddenly, very quickly, in one or two generations, one or more other peoples substituted themselves for it. It is replaced. It is no longer itself. But I want to remind you, you know, while the term Great Replacement has caught on and become the term people are using for it. I prefer the term replacement migration because that's the official term in the UN white paper laying out how this was the plan the entire time, right? If you search Great Replacement, you'll get a bunch of articles about people, you know, trying to discredit it. Search replacement migration, you get the UN white paper from like 2000 that says, yeah, this is what we're doing. We're replacing the population. Of course it's been on purpose. Of course it's racialized. And of course it's all about control. They want to substitute the hard to control Europeans with the easier to control third worlders. That really is it. That's it.
Alex, thanks for having me. Before I start, wanted to pitch a couple of the products there for the listeners. The bovine colostrum's been fantastic. My mom had tremendous results, similar to the results your mom had with her hair and skin. Methylene blue, the mental clarity, the focus has been amazing. I just found that I just needed to up the dose a little bit from the recommendation, and then that really hit. So definitely helps to support the broadcast. Alex, the reason you're so successful and the reason so many people chime in is because you have the best guests. That does include Victor Boot, but I will reference the legendary Gerald Celente. What does he say time after time? When there's nothing left, they take us to war.
The bovine colostrum is incredible. The methylene blue, you fund us. You're our funders, not the Israelis or the Muslims or the Russians or the U.S. government. You fund us at thealexjonesstore.com. And the new news site for all the feeds and articles is alexjoneslive.com. And on Rumble, rumble.com/The Alex Jones Show Live. We'll be right back.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. This is War Room Live. We still have a lot to cover today. We're going to get into what the heck is going on in Albania with the Kushners and the Trumps and the Soroses, for that matter. We'll get into how they're all intertwined. We've got some pretty incredible stories about the SPLC, some results of elections in places like L.A. where Spencer Pratt is looking pretty good against Karen Bass. But I want to stick for a minute to what's going on in the UK to try to illustrate to people just how thorough the two-tier system is, like just how all-encompassing this is and just how outrageous the disparity truly is. So I've got some statements from Keir Starmer about what's happened to Henry Novak. And I also have a bunch of videos and a bunch of statements from Keir Starmer about other instances in the past. We're going to do a little compare and contrast, okay? And we'll start with this post from Sam Ashworth Hayes. And he posts, of course, Keir Starmer's tweet from June 2020, so exactly 6 years ago. He said, "Today at 11 a.m., Parliament held a minute's silence in memory of George Floyd. He must not become just another name. His death must be a catalyst for change. The Labour Party stands with those opposing racism and oppression in the UK and across the world." Sam Ashworth Hayes responds, pointing out the policies and attitudes that led police officers to handcuff a dying man because his killer shouted racist is a completely legitimate response. If you want those policies and attitudes to change, we all have a stake in this. But that presupposes a conversation being held in good faith rather than a government attempting to divert attention from an unpleasant reality. All that distinguishes a case which, quote, must be a catalyst for change from a case where politicians are, quote, exploiting this tragedy to create grievance and division is how difficult the results are for Keir Starmer's worldview to process. I think that's extremely well put. All that distinguishes a case from one which must be a catalyst for change from a case where politicians are exploiting this tragedy to create grievance and division is how difficult the results are for Keir Starmer's worldview to process. I think that's exactly accurate. And again, it shows the absurdity of people who, again, compare George Floyd to Henry Novak. George Floyd had nothing to do with the UK in any possible way. His death wasn't caused by the UK. The laws they have there aren't the same as the ones we have here. Like, it's just totally unrelated to anything to do with the UK. But Keir Starmer believes it must be a catalyst for change in the UK. Meanwhile, Henry Novak, who's life was lost, directly attributable, that murder is directly attributable to the policies that the Labour government puts in place and the policies that actually came about after George Floyd's death and the resulting chaos. But if you try to bring that up, then, you know, you're the one causing grievance and division. I don't know why I have to explain. I don't know why this isn't obvious to absolutely everybody. I really don't. But I'm going to explain it to the slow ones in the back. So this is the way that Keir Starmer responded to Henry Novak. And I'll give him his due. I'll show you what he says about it. All right, let's go to clip 38 first. Henry Novak's family, Keir Starmer says, has lost their son and brother in the most appalling circumstances. And now that evil Nigel Farage is trying to create grievance and division over it. You know, we could have just, hey, a guy gets murdered. It's fine. That's not a problem. But if you start complaining about it, you know, now we're going to have an issue. Let's watch clip 38 now.
Grieving family have asked us not to respond in the way that the leader of reform has responded. They've asked us not to. They have lost their son in the most appalling circumstance. They make a simple plea of us as human beings to please not exploit that. That is their plea to us. We all need to reflect on those words of Henry's father. My response, and the response of others, to be fair, has to be focused on the lessons to be learned so we can deliver justice. His response has been to appeal for rage. Yeah. Rage. That's his response to a father who's lost his son and asked for that not to happen. Exploiting this tragedy to create grievance and division would be wrong in any circumstances, but to do it when the family are expressly saying, please don't, is unforgivable. Yeah. Yeah. It shows exactly who he is.
It's unforgivable, he says. I'm going to clip 45. I mean, he makes this point over and over again. Two-tier Keir finally spoken about Henry Novak. This is from Tommy Robinson. He says, is he condemning the police or the disgusting lying family of Digwa? Of course not. He takes a swipe at Farage for whipping up hatred. Let's go now to clip number 45.
I think Nigel Farage's reaction is the wrong reaction. And I start my answer to your question through the eyes of the family. They have said they do not want this whipped up. They have been through the most extraordinary, awful experience. They don't want this whipped up. And Nigel Farage is completely wrong to use this to try and create division. He would be wrong in any circumstances. But when Henry's family are saying, please don't do that, it's our son, then really, as politicians, as human beings, we should start where they start. And that's where I start. And
so again, the family is pressured to put out this statement, and then it's, you know, used to try to demonize everybody else. Again, you know what this reminds me of, to be honest with you, is Sandy Hook? What it reminds me of is Sandy Hook. No, the person to blame is the murderer. Person who did the bad thing is the murderer. But you're now going to turn around and say, you're hurting the families more than the murder? More than the murderer, because you want to try to actually have solutions for what's going on? Yeah, the reason the family is devastated is because of the murder that occurred. And the murder occurred because of, in one part, the immigration system in the UK, for the second part, in the two-tier system. Which, again, you say you don't have a two-tier system. Why are Sikhs alone allowed to carry 8-inch knives around with them? Like, what do you mean there's no multiple tiers? There obviously is a whole variety of tiers for a variety of different aspects of life. Completely absurd and ridiculous. But not exactly surprising. So that's basically his take. That's basically Keir Starmer's take is, Yeah, this was awful, but, you know, like, don't talk about it. I mean, don't make a big deal out of it. Certainly don't expect any change to come from it. Don't expect the, you know, government to do anything differently as a consequence of this. Certainly, we are not expressing support for the people who are showing outrage about this. Again, he says, and I mean, you can just hear the sincerity through the screen, I think. This is an awful, awful, shocking case, he says. Henry's loved ones have gone through the trauma of a long trial and endured Henry's killer making up appalling claims about their son who was thoughtful, kind, and deeply loved. It's right that the IOPC is investigating the police's response to the senseless murder, and we must end the cycle of tragedy by tackling the horror of knife crime. you know, those dang criminal knives out there. Henry's family, friends, and his university in the city of Southampton will continue to feel his loss, and our thoughts will be with them. Well, I bet they're comforted by that, the thoughts, the various thoughts that you're sending towards them. So nice. Now let's look at something where Keir Starmer actually cares about this stuff. Now let's look at something where Keir Starmer actually cares about the people affected and is actually concerned about what's going on. Clip 39. This was Keir Starmer almost in tears over Islamophobia. With his statements, he contributed to fueling anti-white, anti-Christian hatred. He should spend the rest of his pointless life in prison. So this was after, I don't know, something, certainly not anything like Henry Novak. I mean, I can't think of an instance in the UK where a random, you know, Muslim guy was murdered out of nowhere by a racist white person. But whatever happened, I'm sure it was devastating to the Muslim community. I'm sure somebody put bacon on the ground outside of a mosque, and Keir Starmer is just horrified by all of it. Let's go to clip number 39 now.
We've seen a devastating rise in Islamophobia, leaving people feeling fearful and unsafe in their own country. I've heard firsthand of women wearing hijab who are too scared to travel by public transport, of Muslim families being abused as they leave the mosque. The surge in Islamophobia is simply appalling. Muslim women and girls disproportionately targeted, mosques forced to ramp up security, and British Muslims questioned as if they are terrorists. I do not want Britain to be a place where British Muslims are not able to be their whole selves, where they feel they must hide or tone down who they are for fear of being attached to views that are not their own, where they're asked to apologise for the actions of people who do not act in their name. Our Britain is one where the enormous contributions of British Muslims are recognised and celebrated, their stories heard, their lives free from discrimination. As leader of the Labour Party, I am indebted to the contributions of Muslim members, activists and politicians who make our party what it is today. I'd like to thank Muslim organisations and mosques who work tirelessly to raise awareness and shine a light on the scale of Islamophobia.
See, when Muslims complain, it's shining a light. It's bringing awareness. When white people complain, it's rabble-rousing. It's causing division. I mean, could it be any more egregious? Could he speak with more submission and love of a foreign group of people and more disdain of his own people? I mean, that entire statement, chock full of division, chock full of identity, politics, right? All stuff that he resolutely and angrily rejects when it comes to British people, his own ethnic group, but that he embraces wholeheartedly and understands completely when it comes to the Muslims. It's not that complicated, folks. Of course, when George Floyd died, the middle-aged career criminal in America who overdosed on fentanyl, he didn't feel it was causing division or politicizing anything to take a knee. And, of course, this was retweeted with his quote, "It's important that this incident isn't exploited for anybody's political agenda." I mean, not the George Floyd incident, obviously. That is to be exploited for the political agenda. That's exactly what it's for, even though it has literally nothing to do with British politics at all, remotely, totally unrelated. It will be politicized in Britain. Meanwhile, the attack on the white guy, that's directly the consequence of British policies. That can't be politicized. Okay, are we understanding? Are we getting it? And of course, when not just the US, but the UK burned during the George Floyd riots, Starmer was there saying, "Like you, I was shocked and angered." And you should be shocked and angered, and you're right to go protest. Once again, just flagrant, outrageous difference between two actually very different circumstances. Again, it's not just inequality, it's disequality. It is beyond description. And obviously, it's not just him either. Sadiq Khan, mayor of London, on the 31st of May, 2020, says, The death of George Floyd has rightly ignited fury and anguish, not just in the United States, but around the world. No country, city, police force, or institution can be complacent about racism and the impact this has. And of course, it's Sadiq Khan condemning Nigel Farage for daring to say that the killing of Novak inspired rage. But, you know, the killing of George Floyd ignites fury, which is good. If you're igniting fury, it's good. If you're inspiring rage, you're evil, right? I'm just pointing out these people just genuinely, they don't care about anything that they're saying. This is all just, they just don't like white people. It's not that complicated. Shabana Mahmood, member of parliament in the UK, said something very similar, right? She was also condemning Farage for his inflammatory statements. But she said, many constituents have been in touch with me regarding protests across the United States about the murder of George Floyd. I share their anger at this unspeakable outrage. You can read my letter to constituents here. So again, something happens totally unrelated to the UK. Guy overdoses in police custody in Minneapolis, and they are outraged. They're infuriated. They're making changes. They're altering their system to deal with this problem. But not Henry Novak. Obviously. This is from, you know, just, this is all having to do with George Floyd, right? Two-tier Kier, hypocrisy exposed, full rage for Floyd, zero outrage for Henry Novak. I guess this is clip number 41. Let's go to clip number 41 here. This is two-tier Kier. Let's watch.
The last week has shone a spotlight on the racism, discrimination, and injustice experienced by those from black and minority ethnic communities in the US, in the UK, and across the world. Martin Luther King said, injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. That's why today I've written to the Prime Minister asking for his assurance that the British government is doing all that it can to urge President Trump to respect human rights and the fundamental democratic right to peaceful protest. And this week, Labour has called on the UK government to ensure that our exports are not being used in the suppression of democratic rights in the US. But we must also reflect on the injustices in our own country. We must address the reality and the impact of anti-black racism, which has been highlighted by the Black Lives Matter movement. Now, more than ever, it's incumbent upon us all to ensure that this is a turning point. We must face up to and understand and address the systemic racial discrimination that exists in our own communities. The Labour Party stands with black communities in our country and across the world because black lives matter.
So that was Keir Starmer in 2020, quoting Martin Luther King Jr., outraged, infuriated, politicizing the event because it goes along with what he already believes. As Jay Stewart says on X, Keir Starmer's furious reaction to Floyd contrasted with his pathetic response to Henry Novak's death. Look at Keir Starmer in 2020 shamelessly kneeling and grandstanding over George Floyd, a drug-addicted repeat criminal who died of a fentanyl overdose after resisting arrest. He declared Floyd's death shone a spotlight on the racism, discrimination, and injustice experienced by those from black and minority ethnic communities in the U.S., the U.K., and across the world. He said, quote, we must also reflect on our own injustices in our own country. Now, more than ever, it's incumbent on us to ensure that this is a turning point. We must face up to it and understand and address the systemic racial discrimination that exists. The Labour Party stands with the black community in our country and across the world because black lives matter. What the F was he talking about? There was never any evidence George Floyd's death was about racism, yet Starmer spread this dangerous misinformation and pushed the BLM agenda hard. Fast forward to Henry Novak, an innocent 18-year-old British student stabbed to death. As he lay bleeding, his killer falsely cried racism, and police, terrified of race complaints after years of this toxic training, handcuffed the dying boy instead of saving him. Henry begged for help and died without dignity. Where was Starmer's outrage? Outrage. The same man who made Floyd a martyr now offers weak platitudes and says he felt sick. No kneeling, no grand speeches, no White Lives Matter, no chance he would ever say that. You can draw a straight line from Keir Starmer's 2020 hysteria and Black Lives Matter worship through the race-obsessed policing rules he championed straight to the appalling treatment of Henry Novak. He helped create this climate. Then he became prime minister with the power to implement his dangerous ideas, and he did exactly that. policing is now paralyzed by fear of racism accusations while British kids pay with their lives. This is a national scandal. Keir Starmer owns this disaster. What a spineless two-tier hypocrite, a complete and utter disgrace to Britain. But we don't have to go back to 2020. We don't have to go back to 2024. We can go 2 months back. Exactly 1 month ago, there was an attack at Golders Green. The thing is, it wasn't a racist attack. It didn't have any elements of racism really there. In fact, it was seemingly a totally random stabbing in which a Muslim was stabbed first, followed by two Jewish guys got stabbed. None of them died, but they did receive wounds. From the Middle East side, Golders Green attack, a Muslim was also stabbed, not that you'd know. Ishmael Hussein, a Muslim man, was stabbed in London last Wednesday. His alleged assailant has now been apprehended and charged with attempted murder. But you wouldn't necessarily know that if you read the headlines, watched the breaking news reports, or listened to the opinions of the commentariat and the political class. That's because the accused, Essa Suleiman, was the same man charged with stabbing two Jewish men later that day in the city's Golders Green area, home to a large Jewish population. So basically, there are headlines that are like, two Jewish men stabbed, and it's like, well, and a Muslim guy. But they wanted to portray it as a racial attack, even though there wasn't evidence that that was the case. And this was the way Keir Starmer reacted to that. We can go to clip number 43 now. So again, Henry Novak dies in a racially motivated, racially tainted attack where police accuse him of being a racist, you know, handcuff him as he lays dying. He does die from it. And Keir Starmer's response is basically, shut up. You're not allowed to politicize this. You can't do anything about this. And even the hint of the suggestion that we should do something, you know, systemically to deal with the consequences of all this stuff is outrageous. And you're the bad one for making that statement. Meanwhile, two Jewish guys get randomly stabbed, don't die. And this is Keir Starmer's response.
Just held a COBRA meeting, bringing together all the relevant partners, including the Home Secretary, the London Mayor, the Metropolitan Commissioner, to coordinate our response and to look at enhanced security. I've also spoken to CST. There is enhanced funding already in place. We need to increase that to give the level of protection that is needed. But of course, it's our responsibility to coordinate the immediate response here to this appalling attack, to ensure security is in place, to take other measures. I'm holding a meeting tomorrow with the criminal justice agencies to make sure that we can have effective and swift justice in these cases. But we do have to recognise the levels of anxiety and concern there are that I know about in terms of the Jewish community feeling very much exposed and vulnerable, feeling they've got to hide their identity, sometimes in the health service, sometimes at school, on the streets where they live. And it's our job to make sure that they feel safe and secure. It's our job make sure that we absolutely deal with the roots of anti-Semitism and extremism. That is what we will do.
So again, it's not just, you know, different, you know, a different approach here where it's a white person. It's, you know, literally everybody else gets his care and concern, empathy. He understands why they're scared. He wants to do things. He's giving them money to deal with it. You know, all of this stuff is not just necessary. You know, it's like incumbent on them to do it, and they would be sinning if they didn't. But then a white guy gets stabbed, and it's just like, well, too bad. I mean, I'm super sad. It's super sad. But like, how dare you suggest we do anything about it? How dare you? When there's a random stabbing, two Jews get sliced but not killed, it's all hands on deck. I've called an emergency COBRA meeting. We're releasing funds. We're listening to the community. We're doing everything we possibly can to ensure their safety in this trying time. Oh, a white guy got stabbed? Who cares? Who cares? He probably deserved it. He probably was racist, even if he didn't say it, right? You know, I don't know what else to tell you, but like, they hate you. Like, the people that run the UK hate the people of the UK and are destroying them. And like, that's it. That's just what's happening. You have to overthrow them. I'll tell you more on the other side. It just goes on and on.
Inflation is up. That's an issue. So how does Berkshire handle that with its business?
Well, we can't handle runaway inflation except not to be there in the way of it. If you look at the number of countries that have had runaway inflation since World War II, you know, in my lifetime, it's very large. Once you create that, it becomes a different world. And of course, you have countries that have gone bankrupt like 6 or 7 times. I mean, it's just amazing what people do. Not having faith in the money does to a country. It turns it into something else.
Dollar collapse means we keep continuing on where we are. Dollar devalues. We've got massive inflation. You raise interest rates to slow that inflation down. So this is going to have a cataclysmic effect on the insurance industry, on pension funds, on everything. And let's be clear, though,
a dollar being the world currency is how we could just print it and buy whatever we wanted. If the world sees it like the Mexican peso or worse, we're screwed. So here's Prince Charles, the king, announcing the digital chains, the mark of the beast system, and a dovetail with Tony Blair, who's globally, through the UN and Bill Gates, standardized the world ID that the UK, under orders of the king, I thought he's just ceremonial, no, he could dissolve Parliament anytime he wants, is now going into place. This all ties into everything. We'll talk to the top economist and great patriot, Peter Kirkelly, in a moment about it, but here's the clips.
My ministers will also proceed with the introduction of digital ID that will modernize how citizens interact with public services.
Tell us a bit about what it means for what government should do in terms of its digital infrastructure, digital ID, data centers, and so on.
The first thing a country needs to do is to unify all of their data so it can be consumed and used by the AI model. You have to take all of your healthcare data, your diagnostic data, your electronic health records, your genomic data. We have to take all of this data we have in our country and move it into a single, if you will, unified data platform.
What they do is Oracle make big donations to Tony Blair's Institute, and Tony Blair's Institute advocates for further advantages for Oracle and Oracle-affiliated entities. Listen, the centralization of data and the centralization of power is part of a dark and nefarious agenda.
People are really crazy if they don't call you. You're on record, the biggest company, because you have the best ratings, the best gold and silver prices. It is the smart move. Get a free consultation, they can roll over financial instruments.
This should be a happy time, right? So don't let the news scare you, but rather use the wisdom, the creativity that God gave you. Go into tangible assets that have zero counterparty risk. Silver was up over 140% last year. Since January 30th, when it corrected and it had a 50% correction, went down into the 60s, it's almost 90. Literally, since February, silver's up over 30%, Alex. There is a path to safety here financially, and that's what tangible assets do. This is what
God
the numbers
always
are
gives
telling
his
us.
People a way out, but the people perish always. For lack of knowledge.
Always. He always does. He's never going to say something, even if it's the mark of the beast. When he talks about it in Revelation, he's not going to say something unless we have a choice to either accept or reject, because he didn't create robots.
KEPM.com/gold. Sign up for the email there to get a free consultation. We'll call you right back. Or you can call the number 720-605-3000. The smartest investment you could have made in the last 3 years. I'm telling you right now, this is the place to go. 720-605-3000.
Days, weeks, and even years ahead of the news cycle. AlexJonesLive.com is tomorrow's news today.
All right, folks, we are going to move on. I promise we're going to move on. I got to show you the level of response that Keir Starmer had to the Golders Green attack compared to Henry Novak. Okay? So I'm sorry if I'm repeating, but like, I really think you gotta hammer this home. Just to illustrate the just cowardice of Keir Starmer, really, at the end of the day. So again, Henry Novak, clearly the consequence of police policy, police training, and the racism aspect is baked in because the murderer claimed he was racist and that caused the police to ignore his cries for help, obviously, right? However, if you want to talk about changing policy to deal with this, if you want to talk about how this was the consequence of government policy and therefore it can be altered by government policy, then Keir Starmer will say that you're whipping up division. He'll accuse Nigel Farage of exploiting this situation to create grievance and division. He says it's completely unforgivable, totally unforgivable to do things like try to come up with some sort of policy change to mitigate the risk of such a horrifying thing happening in the future. Meanwhile, when two Jewish people were stabbed, not to death, but by a random Muslim dude who also stabbed a Muslim guy, this was Keir Starmer's response. So come to a dot cam for me. This was 1 month ago. 1 month ago, two Jewish people were lightly stabbed, and this was his response. First, an 18-minute live stream conference dedicated to talking about it. Then you had, and these are clips from the attack. We can go to clip number, or from the press conference. We can go to clip 42 here, where he says this was a vile terrorist attack that attacked Jews because they're Jews. I guess he's not causing division with this. I guess he's not exploiting grievance with this. I guess this isn't, you know, taking advantage of the situation to politicize it. This is normal. This is reasonable. This is, you know, the adults in the room, I guess, when it's Jews. Let's watch.
Good evening. Earlier today, on Yom Kippur, the holiest day for the Jewish community, a vile individual committed a terrorist attack that attacked Jews because they are Jews and attacked Britain because of our values. So many Jewish families first came to this country as a place of refuge, fleeing the greatest evil ever inflicted on a people. And Britain welcomed them. Communities like the one attacked in Manchester provided safety, but also the security that comes from a promise that this is a country that stands up to hatred and that we don't just provide refuge, we provide a home. For so many Jewish families, that is the story of Britain. But Britain is also
we can go ahead and take it down. But like, do you hear the attitude? Do you hear the passion, the feeling? We will do everything we possibly can to protect you. This is a failure of our entire system. Really, because a white kid just got stabbed because he's white by a, you know, radical minority who accused him of being racist. Keir Starmer's just like, okay, and? So what? What are you, a white supremacist? So, following a very minor attack against some random Jewish people, he gives an 18-minute speech where he says it was a vile terrorist attack that attacked Jews because they're Jews. Anti-Semitism is a hatred that's rising once again. Britain must defeat it once again. To every Jewish person in this country, I promise I will do everything in my power to guarantee you the security you deserve. Like, how crazy would it be to hear him say that about white people? How crazy would it be to hear Keir Starmer say to every white person in this country, I promise to do everything in my power to guarantee you the security you deserve. You don't deserve it. That's the issue. The Jews do. When there's an Islamophobic attack, he is practically in tears, crying about the vile hatred from the evil whites. I'm deeply concerned. Again, this is back 1 month ago, April 29th, 2026. The Golders Green random stabbing. I'm deeply concerned about the terrorist attack that took place today. This is not an isolated incident. It's the latest in a spat of utterly vile attacks on the Jewish community. I've just chaired an emergency COBRA meeting, and tomorrow I'll be bringing together criminal justice agencies to ensure we have effective and swift justice. Right? No holds barred. No claim too great. They will do everything in their power to protect the precious Jewish people. White people can get stuffed. Again, like, he just goes on and on. These are all tweets from Keir Starmer from that one event. Remember, the only tweets about Henry Novak are him going, yeah, it's sad, but, you know, Nigel Farage needs to shut up. Okay, yes, we're all very sad about Henry Novak. The last thing we should do is do anything about what led to his murder. We shouldn't even investigate it, really. Flashback 1 month ago, yesterday's terrorist attack was not an isolated incident. It was the latest attack on the Jewish community for being Jewish. Yesterday, I spoke with volunteers, first responders from Shamrim, which is the private Jewish police force they're allowed to have with poorly trained officers running around with guns because, hey, if you're Sikh, you get to carry around a knife. If you're Jewish, you get to have a private militias protect you. And Keir Starmer is there meeting with them to guarantee they have everything they could possibly need, which means tens of millions of dollars. And Hatzola, to thank them for their bravery. I know that this is a deeply worrying time for the whole community. My government is taking immediate action. We've increased enhanced funding for police patrols and protective security, and we're fast-tracking legislation to deal with malign state actors. My message to Jewish people is this. You belong here, and we will do everything we can to keep you safe. If you've seen a little bit of a difference, a little bit of a difference between one identity group and another. I don't know if Keir Starmer's being married to a Jewish woman has anything to do with it, but he certainly cares a hell of a lot more. We're not done. He continued, the anti-Semitic attack on Golders Green is utterly appalling. Attacks on our Jewish community are attacks on Britain. Thank you, Shamrin, Hatzola, and the police for acting swiftly. Those responsible will be brought to justice. The recent attacks targeting Jewish communities are appalling. We're working closely with the police, security services, and CST to bring Jewish communities, disrupt extremist threats, and bring those responsible to justice. We must defeat the poison of anti-Semitism. The Britain I want is a Britain where people can practice their religion, their faith, in security and safety. Again, it's like, are you kidding me? It goes on. And this is where it gets real crazy. This is where it gets actually like nuts, okay? He starts writing articles about how we have to, you know, have a political response to this attack. And again, a much, much more minor attack, an attack that really had nothing to do with the identity of the Jews. Like, it was a random attack. The dude stabbed a Muslim. He stabbed two Jews. He was like an insane person that, by the way, had been on some sort of like terror watch list in the UK for a long time. They let him out to go do this. Regardless, we won't relent in our fight against anti-Semitism and terror. Any perpetrators will feel the full force of the law. Seven arrests after planned arson on Jewish community in London. So this actually was following the, like, you know, the stabbing in the Golders Green community. There were like multiple instances where there was like a fire at a house next door to a synagogue, and the BBC and British media were running like four or five of these stories of like the attacks continue, and none of them were actually attacks. None of them were arson. None of them, it didn't exist, but they took random events like a fire near a synagogue to run headlines. Fire near synagogue, you know, exposes rash of anti-Semitic violence. He goes on. I'm appalled by the recent anti-Semitic arson attacks in North London. This is abhorrent and must not be tolerated. Attacks on our Jewish community are attacks on Britain. We are increasing visible policing, and those responsible will be found and brought to justice. We will not rest in the pursuit of perpetrators. He goes on. We must build a stronger country. If we are to build a fairer country, that is the mission of my government and the promise of change that we will deliver. So this was a op-ed he wrote for The Observer following the attack on Golders Green about how we needed systematic change to deal with the problem of anti-Semitic violence. But if you call out anti-white violence, you're the bad guy. Get a load of this, folks. This is from his op-ed in The Observer following the attacks on Golders Green. He says this, quote, we have a choice. We could sink into the politics of grievance and division, or we could rise to this moment together in a national effort that matches the scale and the threats of the turbulence that we face. Do you understand what he's saying? This man is saying that if you call for political change as a consequence of the Henry Novak murder, you are causing division and taking advantage of grief. If, however, you call for systematic change as a consequence of Jewish people being attacked, opposing the change makes you guilty of causing division and taking advantage of grievance. But do you understand what I just said? Like, he literally makes the argument that not politicizing the attack, not bringing identity into it, not, you know, pouring out extra concern for the Jewish community because the Jewish people were attacked. If you don't do that, you're causing division and grievance. If you do exactly the same thing for white people, now you're the one causing grievance. Like, are you kidding me? Are you kidding me? And then he wrote another. And then he has a personal Substack where he wrote articles. Facing the challenge of this moment, there are moments in history that shape our future for generations where we have to decide who we are as a country. This is one of those moments. Again, two Jewish guys get poked with a knife, and this is his response. Every single two, I mean, every single one of these, it goes on and on and on. He's writing op-eds. He's writing articles. He's changing laws. He's accusing you of being the one causing division if you don't want to change the laws. It goes on and on and on. Henry Novak gets killed. It's directly attributable to the government policies and the racism that Keir Starmer himself promotes. And it's shut up. You're causing division and grief by talking about it. So hopefully it's clear now. Hopefully I've made the case that Keir Starmer just literally hates white people and will pour out endless empathy and concern for literally everybody else. Doesn't matter who it is. Doesn't matter if the attack is real. Doesn't matter if it's actually racialized. Doesn't matter if it actually has political implications. He will politicize it. He will racialize it. He will take advantage of it. He will cry crocodile tears. And he will swear and pledge the poll of the British government in support of those people as long as they're Muslim or Jewish or Sikh or Hindu or just not white. As long as they're not white, he is at your beck and call. If it's Henry Novak, you're going to go to jail for talking about it. So I don't know what else there is to say. Let's go to clip 44 here. This is a woman being interviewed by GB News about how it feels to be a English woman with the current state of the British police. Let's watch.
You've come down to protest today. What is it that brought you down here?
Because in my opinion, I feel that the police are now so racist towards anyone white or English or anyone who even looks like me. I would never dare speak to them to report crime. I would not email them or phone them. I do not trust them not to be racist towards me. And at a residence meeting on Thursday, I was not able to come here last Thursday because I went to a residence police meeting. I told the police straight, I will never report crime to you. I will never speak to a police person alone. I do not trust you. You are racist towards the English and white people. And we will not stand for it.
Now, I think she's exactly right. And it's very sad that that's the case. At the end of the day, I genuinely think it's just because white people don't do anything. We don't do anything. Like, I don't think they actually love Muslim people. I don't think they actually hate white people. I think that they know that if they're racist to a Muslim person, then they're going to lose their job because the Muslim interest group are going to hound the people. They're going to have it on the media. They're going to get sympathetic ears. They're going to make a big deal out of it. They're going to ruin your job. Like, as police, they're sitting there going, dang, if I do something wrong, that community is going to come after me. I better not mess with them. The white people, they know. They know they can screw you. They know they can throw you in jail over a tweet. They know they can abuse you or let you bleed out to death while calling you a racist. And they know that they're not going to suffer the consequences, any consequences whatsoever. I think that's why. I really don't think the British police are running around going, we love Muslims. They're just scared of Muslims. They're not scared of white people. They are scared of Muslims. I think that's it. I don't think it's that, like, much more complicated. And I think it's because, honestly, the British people have allowed themselves to be, you know, picked off one by one. The other communities don't do that. They come together and they use collective power to make demands and they get results. The white people have been trained not to do that. And the power structure knows that, and they know they can abuse white people, and the other white people will go along with it. Which we could go on and on about that, too. We're going to move on now. I do want to remind you to go to thealexjonesstore.com. It is your last week to be entered to win both the Hummer H1 custom vehicle, just very cool H1 Hummer, sort of a classic style, not like the new Hummers, or the 2026 Dodge Charger plus $20,000 in cash. Every dollar you spend this week, it's 100 times entries to both. And almost everybody who's won a car, and there have been a lot of people who've won cars from thealexjonesstore.com and $10,000 cash, they almost all win them in this last crossover week because you're getting so many more entries this week So you can be entered to win both with any purchase. Plus, you're getting free shipping at $99, free CMOS capsules. If you spend $125, if you spend $175 at thealexjonesstore.com, you get free Shilajit capsules on top of all of those. And, of course, our products are the best of the best. And you will experience the difference if you give them a try. TheAlexJonesStore.com, TheAlexJonesStore.com/Harrison to let them know who sent you. Now, we'd been hearing about a protest in Frisco, Texas by a Muslim guy. It was an anti-white rally that he wanted to hold. He said anti-redneck, but we all know what that means. He just hates white people. His name was Zul Muhammad, and it didn't go very well for him. It didn't turn out like he thought it would. And we'll go to some of these. Let's just go to clip 53 here. This is Zul Muhammad, a Carrollton resident, who, by the way, is currently like facing a bunch of charges. I'll find the charges that he's facing here in just a second. But yeah, his anti-white rally in Frisco, Texas, didn't turn out the way that he thought it would. Let's watch.
But I think yes, they did a pretty good job here.
I support a woman's right to abortion.
I don't think anybody should be regulated on that. That's
not regulated at all?
Explain the regulation.
Okay, like at what point? At one point in the pregnancy, is it okay to abort?
What are they doing right now? Well, what was it previous to Roe versus Wade?
I'm asking you that. I'm not asking you what the question is right now.
It's probably 6 weeks from what I know.
Why?
I'm not a doctor. Even if it was later than that, if you have something growing in your body and you don't want it there, I'm all for it. You know, I'm all for abortion.
You don't think it's a baby? At what point is it a baby?
Even if it was later on,
what is it?
It doesn't really bother me.
All right, so that's him arguing about abortion because he's just completely surrounded by rednecks. Oh, what do you know? You're surrounded by rednecks. Let's go to clip 57 here. This is the moment that Zul Muhammad showed up to his own anti-redneck rally to find he was the only one there on his side. Let's watch clip 57 here. Not very fit. So he's the guy yelling in the middle there. You know, being approached by all these people. Yeah, how'd that show of force turn out for you? How'd that work out for you, buddy? Yeah, didn't go perhaps the way that he thought it would. Let's go to clip number 54 here. I believe this is Nikki Rudd at Nikki Rudd X on X. I believe that's 54 here. Here's his coverage.
So here we are, guys, at what was supposed to be the anti-Indian immigration in the Frisco protest, but now you can see it's devolved into a pressure cooker of Muslims protest, okay?
They're all, like, surrounding one guy all by himself in there.
How is this productive? What are we doing here? Is this going to actually, like, stop Indian immigration that's taking over Frisco? Or is this actually just giving fire to the fuel of all of our enemies and making us look stupid? I would say that's probably what it's doing. Let's be smart about what we say. Let's be strategic. Let's use the political power we have to pressure those who hold government office and make them bend the law to our will to save our state and to save our country. That should be the focus. That's what we're trying to do here at Riff TV going forward.
Okay, so I guess he's on Riff TV. Look, I agree with that. I don't agree with, you know, making threats against these people. Like, we is our home. Like, we have the right to deny these people, and we have an ability to do it politically, and that's what we have to do. However, we're not the ones that organized this rally. This Zul Muhammad guy did. So, of course, it's right for Americans to show up and tell him to go F himself because he's a visitor to this country and making demands that he has no right to make. Let's go to this one. Zul Muhammad finally shows up to his anti-white rally and he's faced off by patriots in Frisco, Texas. This looks like it'll be number 55 here. Let's go to 55. So there you go. Yeah, his anti-redneck rally didn't really work out too well, did it? Yeah, it didn't really go the way that he thought it would. Oh, darn it. Oh, darn. He's getting in the face of everybody. Yeah, we need to see more of this. We need to see more pressure against these people. Who the hell do they think they are? This is from Sarah Fields at Sarah is Censored on X. And this is alleged, I guess. Zol Muhammad is a Carrollton resident who's currently facing multiple felony charges and is also a candidate for Carrollton mayor in the 2026 election. In 2024, Muhammad pled guilty to more than 100 felony counts related to mail-in ballot fraud scheme carried out during his failed 2020 Carrollton mayoral campaign. Yesterday, he decided to hold an anti-redneck rally at Frisco City Hall. The rally did not go well for him. Hundreds of redneck patriots showed up when he arrived completely alone with no visible support. Many of us confronted him about his views. During these conversations, he stated he does not support veterans, a bold statement considering that a large number of us there were veterans. He also said he wanted to dismantle the U.S. government and rebuild it while incorporating certain aspects of Sharia law. At one point, I confronted him on the topic of abortion, and that was the video that we saw earlier. When people tell you who they are, listen to them, ask your questions, and let them answer. They'll reveal exactly who they are. This man should not be in any elected position in America. He shouldn't be in America. He shouldn't be in America, and we are under no obligation to allow him to be in America. It's our country. It's our home. This is our house. He doesn't get to come in and tell us that we're the bad people in our house. He needs to go home. He needs to be sent home wherever that is. Or needs to be sent somewhere. I don't even care if he's sent home. Somewhere that's not America. He doesn't belong here. Let's go to clip 56 here. Somebody showed up to the anti-redneck rally with a big box truck with TV screens displaying White Lives Matter and deport all illegals, deport all Indians. A patriot with a box truck. This is great to see. Let's watch. So there you see the White Lives Matter back there with Irina Zarutska, Austin Metcalf, Henry Novak, and Charlie Kirk. And these are the rednecks that showed up. That's cool. I like these guys. We strongly condemn the use of Indian flags at hateful rallies. Literally all you have to do is show just like a modicum of respect for America. It's really not hard, and it's really offensive that most people, that's too far. It's too much to ask that they literally show just basic respect for our country, our way of life, our laws, and they just can't do it. They can't handle it. They can't bring themselves to simply try to live within the rules of the country that they've decided to move to. They've decided to move here. They've made the choice to become Americans. Only they have no interest in becoming Americans, no respect for Americans that live here. They literally see us as an economic zone to exploit, and they're fairly open about that. Anybody who's not like that, anybody that actually respects America, actually wants to become a citizen, actually understands and reveres our history and our foundational principles, we wouldn't have a problem with. But there's way too many people like this Zol Muhammad guy who thinks he has a right to come into our country and treat us like dirt. We should send him back where he came from. Or whatever.
Folks, I'm Dr. Bigley. Today's presentation will be about methylene blue and you.
Dr. Bigley, what does methylene blue do?
Great question, Billy. It has to do with your mitochondria, the powerhouse of your cells. Let's bring out the mitochondria now!
Right.
As I was saying, methylene blue supercharges your mitochondria, which does wonders for your mental clarity, stamina, and overall pep. Just look at him go!
Gee, Dr. Bigley, he must have drank a lot of methylene blue. He was bouncing off the walls.
Right you are, Billy. He sure drank a lot. Let's continue, shall we?
Billy, did you know that methylene blue can cure communism?
No, sir. Can I see?
Why, certainly, Billy. Take a look over there.
Behold, Ivan, a Ruski doggedly determined to undermine our way of life.
Careful, Billy. He bites. Oh. Look. Vodka. Potato hooch.
Watch. The communism is slowly leaving his body.
Wow. The methylene blue cured the red right out of him.
So, how do you feel?
Gee, Doc, I don't know what got into me. I feel like $1 million now. Say, where can I get some more of that blue stuff in case I become retarded again?
You can find it on the alexjonesstore.com.
What does .com mean?
Days, weeks, and even years ahead of the news cycle, alexjoneslive.com is tomorrow's news today.
What's happening in Albania? A lot of people are asking that question these days. A lot of people are wondering what's really going on with the Kushners, with Jared and Ivanka. A lot of people a little curious as to what could really be behind their attempt to purchase a private island with a military installation. Let's go to clip number 5 first. This is from a Syrian girl at Partisan Girl. She posted this. It's actually from a user named Ash. Ivanka Trump and Jared Kushner's private luxury island in Albania is actually going to be an Israeli military base complete with nuclear bunkers. Ivanka and her dad have always had a nuclear bunker nearby. That's why they have no problem starting World War III. Let's watch.
Well, well, well. Turns out that Ivanka Trump and Jared Kushner aren't just buying a private island to build a luxury resort. Sazan Island is Albania's largest island and is strategically located, once an isolated, top-secret Cold War military base featuring thousands of bunkers and miles of tunnels. Now, why in the world would our United States Special Envoy for Peace Missions need an island with all of that? So when Ivanka said this,
big opportunity to help realize its potential and transform it, but with a lot of restraint and care because the land is so beautiful that really the architecture has to be fully integrated into it, almost rise from it.
That's such a sweet story about preserving the beautiful land and the nature and building the architecture around that. But I wonder if you're building the architecture around something else. It's important to note that the Albanian people are not happy about this, and they're protesting in the thousands, and they're also demanding that the prime minister resign for allowing such a corrupt deal to go through. But again, I'm sure this purchase is just to build a big, beautiful luxury resort, not a personal bunker on an island. As always, I want to hear what you think about all of this down below.
And yeah, the Albanians are not happy with, you know, one of their islands being sold to the Kushners. We can go to this Al Jazeera video about it, clip number 9. This is them trying to, a Syrian girl uses Israel as a verb. They're trying to Israel an island in Albania. Let's watch. I'll read along. Albanians fight to save protected wetlands from Trump's son-in-law, chanting Albania for Albanians. It's one of the last untouched coastal areas of the Mediterranean. Jared Kushner wants to turn huge swaths of it into a luxury resort. People chanting, don't defend the oligarchs. Those are citizens' properties. Who do you serve, citizens or the oligarchs? And you see the barbed wire set up. Protesters confronted security guards at the construction site for the project. And thousands have flooded the capital demanding construction be shut down. There's a great public outrage over what's happening in Albania. But the spark was what happened in Zvernik, which everyone saw on social media. An activist being dragged along by the ground by several people wearing black shirts from a security company because he was protesting against a fence that had been installed there illegally. The resort is set to be built in an uninhabited island in nearby lagoon with coastal wetlands. The habitat support nesting turtles and migratory birds. Ivanka Trump infuriated protesters when she described the land as if she and Kushner discovered it.
We were on a friend's boat and we stopped for a swim. Effectively, that's how we found it.
Albanian Prime Minister Edi Rama worked with Kushner to approve the project, estimated at $4 billion in 2024. Anti-corruption authorities have now launched an investigation into the deal after sudden changes to the land's protected status. Resignation, resignation, people are chanting. Kushner and his investors say the project will respect the local ecology. But their plans include building 10,000 hotel rooms and a marina for yachts, which locals say will pollute the protected waters with sewage. So it's kind of typical, isn't it? Jared Kushner, Ivanka Kushner want something, so they get it. And hey, it's protected wetlands. Well, not anymore. The protection status has changed to allow them to do what they want. And they can set up an illegal fence and, I guess, abuse and arrest the protesters there. Because why not? It's worldwide Israel, coming soon. Add Albania to the ever-growing list of colonies that the Israelis are establishing. But it gets crazy, folks. The Soroses are in on this.
I'll start with sexual Tyrannosaurus Rex.
This is rocket fuel. This is incredible. This is rocket fuel. Because I'm a sexual Tyrannosaurus Rex. This is a cocktail I drink every day. A squirt of ultramethylene blue and T3. You are insane if you don't get it. Okay. Well, listen. You are insane if you don't get it. I am a wrecking ball. I am obsessed with this. I can't stop. And now I'm having this. Because I'm a sexual Tyrannosaurus Rex. This is the truth. Because I'm a sexual Tyrannosaurus Rex. You understand that? Does that burn into your brain?
I think I'm going to buy some methylene blue now.
TheAlexJonesShow.com.
Back, folks. War Room Live. Final hour is on. Talking about Albania and what exactly Jared Kushner and Ivanka Trump are up to there. They're making videos defending their attempt to create a giant luxury resort on this defunct military site on an island off the coast of Albania. And the Albanians are not happy about this. Let's go first, clip number 7. This is Ivanka Trump announcing the massive off-grid private island and what they'll be doing with it. Let's go to Ivanka Trump now.
I'm working on an incredible project with my husband in the Mediterranean. It's massive in scale.
I think that's an understatement. Can you explain?
Yes, it is. It is.
There's no power on this island. You're building everything from scratch. Correct.
Well, it's an unbelievable, beautiful 1,400-hectare private island in the middle of the Mediterranean. We were on a friend's boat, and we stopped for a swim. Effectively, that's how we found it. We swam to the islands. We went on a hike, barefoot all the way up to the top, and we were just captivated. And it stayed with us ever since. And over the course of many years, we developed the opportunity to help realize its potential and transform it, but with a lot of restraint and care because the land is so beautiful that really the architecture has to be fully integrated into it, almost rise from it. You know, it's not even a business for me, despite the scale of it. We not only the island, but we have 5 miles of beachfront directly across from the island, this beautiful peninsula with a lagoon on one side, the ocean on the other, beautiful white sand beaches. For me, it feels more like a challenge than anything else. The culmination of all of my experience in real estate, all of my travel, a lot of reflection on how I want to live, how I think people increasingly are wanting to live and trying to really build something that's a tangible manifestation of that. That requires a lot of vision, the collaboration of some of the greatest masters that exist. So I was just there walking the land, really just trying to sort of be with it and experience it alongside some of the greatest living architects of our time, like true masters of their craft, people with integrity so absolute, like there will be no compromise. And that's something we want to create there. So we're very excited.
Wow. Amazing. So uplifting. So inspiring. I loved Glenn Greenwald's response to this video you just watched. He says, the most darkly funny aspect of this video is that Ivanka Trump speaks as if she went on some profound, prolonged spiritual and philosophical journey to ascertain the meaning of life and concluded that the most elevated human state is to live on a gigantic private island in the Mediterranean in a sprawling mansion paid for with the billions of dollars given to her husband by the Saudis and Emiratis to ensure favorable treatment by him and her dad in their exercising of powers of the American presidency. Real uplifting stuff. Real incredible stuff. Walked barefoot to the beach. It was just amazing. Just so amazing. I picture them, I mean, they were saying similar stuff about, like, Gaza, you know? Just beautiful and amazing. Here's Jared Kushner describing it, clip 8. Turns out the friend's boat they were on when they made this spontaneous swimming excursion that changed their lives and enlightened them to the beauty of Albania. It was Nathaniel Rothschild's boat, of all people. Isn't that interesting? Let's watch.
I was on a vacation after we left government in the summer of 2021. We were on our friend Nat Rothschild's boat. We got picked up in Montenegro, and then we started sailing over to Corfu, and we spent a couple days in Albania. One of the nights there, Prime Minister Rama came to the boat. I had not met him when I was in government, but I was very, very impressed with his vision for what he wanted to do with Albania. I really didn't know anything about the country. I didn't understand the history. And the darkness of the history with the communism and the terrible leadership actually led to it being fully undeveloped as a nation. But Eddie came in. He has one of the cool things I was attracted to is the fact that he seemed like a very skilled politician, as a very strong and smart leader, but also the fact that he was an artist. I thought it'd be very cool to see what a country really led and built by an artist could be, somebody with amazing taste and great creativity. And so I was just intrigued by it. And then before we went to Corfu, we stopped in Butrent, which was also a spectacular sight, and just really felt to me like it showed the potential of the country. So much amazing beauty, the water. We did a lot of swimming, a lot of hiking. The country just had incredible natural beauty, but it seemed like a place that nobody knew or understood. And so didn't think much about it for about a year. And then about a year later, we started looking at opportunities in the Balkans. And the partner who's leading that effort, I said, you know what, let's go down to Albania. I had such a good experience there. Go check it out, see if there's something there. And we were immediately drawn to where they were building an airport in Vlorë. And obviously a country is going to build an airport by the coast in the place that they think is the most beautiful. So we went there, we looked for opportunities, and we were able to find some incredible, incredible opportunities. So this really came from obviously a passion, and it came from the desire to build something that I think could be truly unique in the world.
Wow. Amazing. Incredible. Jared Kushner admits Nate Rothschild helped him secure a remote private island during yacht vacation. I mean, yeah, seriously, could you be more out of touch? They picked us up in Montenegro, and we spent a while yachting around Corfu during the off season. It's just like, you people. And remember, Jared Kushner was supposed to not, like, President Trump promised on the campaign trail, he said, Kushner's out. We're not doing anything. He's not going to be a part of this at all. We've heard you. You didn't like Kushner being involved the first time. He's not going to be involved. Suddenly, he has basically become the main negotiator for all of this. And, of course, you remember he was with Steve Witkoff when Witkoff made a little bit of a slip that old Kushner had been planning the redevelopment of Gaza for about a year before October 7th ever happened. Whoops, kind of let that one slip a little bit. And they've been working on Albania since at least 2024. I'll tell you that story in just a second. But Albania's not very happy with Elder of Zion, Jared Kushner. They're actually very angry about this. Over 100,000 Albanians shut down the capital in furious protest. Trump and Kushner are selling off the Albanian coastline to Jewish billionaires and Israeli military projects. The south of the country is being handed over to foreign control. Here's what the protests looked like in the capital city. See, they don't want the Kushners to be there, but the Kushners do want to be there. So who do you think is going to win? People of the country or the international billionaires? Who do we think is going to win this contest? So Kushner's one of these people, has been raised from birth to assume his role as, you know, unelected leader of the world for some reason. But the people of Albania are not happy about it, and now Albania has responded to the outrage by launching a corruption investigation, and they've now frozen the assets in Kushner's resort probe. A widening property fraud investigation into a $4 billion luxury resort linked to Jared Kushner has led Albanian authorities to freeze developer assets, compounding pressure from public protest and international critics. Albanian anti-corruption prosecutors on Tuesday froze the bank account of a landholding company tied to a controversial $4 billion luxury resort project backed by Jared Kushner, President Donald Trump's son-in-law. The escalating crisis over the coastal developments has triggered mass protests, a sharp diplomatic rift with neighboring Greece, and stern warnings from the European Union. But of course, I imagine that as we speak, American diplomats are, you know, calling their Albanian counterparts into meetings and threatening, you know, military action from America if they don't serve the Kushner's private, you know, personal property profile, family business. Then I saw this post and I had me asking some questions. Henry Fjord on X says, it's so funny how people think there are different sides, with a picture of Alexander Soros from this week, pointing and hugging the president of Albania, the very same president that Jared Kushner was just singing the praises of. He's an artist. He's an artist. So he doesn't really know how to manage political affairs. So we're able to take advantage of him pretty well. And apparently George Soros, also best friends with him. My brother, Adir Amal, turned 60 last week. It was an honor to spend time in Albania together. You're an inspiration to the world, brother. 60, it's the new 40. It's kind of interesting, isn't it? Kushner's and the Soros's in it together. So I look into it. I go, why do the Kushner's and the Soros's both seem to be in Albania right now? Why are they working together? What is this? And is this more than just, you know, an Israeli outpost? Because that's what it seems to be. Because it seems like in Argentina and Patagonia, they're setting up sort of a mini Israel satellite state. They're doing it in Albania. They're doing it on other islands off the coast of Greece. They're doing it in Ukraine. They're doing it in Russia. So then you have this from November 14th, 2024. Alexander Soros, Jared Kushner, reportedly obsessed with Albania. Billionaire boys, Jared Kushner and Alexander Soros, right? Both, you know, Jewish princes of the, you know, Jewish aristocracy, right? Neither one of them earned anything in their lives. They're both just the children of elite Zionist families. So, of course, they get to manage billions of dollars of unearned money. They may be on the opposite political spectrum. Are they, though? I don't think that's true. But they both reportedly love Albania, a land of newly minted oligarchs. Kushner ruffled feathers earlier this year when he announced plans to build an opulent hotel and beach villa complex on a stretch of the mainland where an Albanian family has farmed for generations. According to the New York Times, the family says part of the property was corruptly seized from them after the end of communist rule in 1991. Kushner also plans to build an international airport near the seaside development and is eyeing another property, a small strategically located island called Sazan. But for Kushner, a noted developer, this is a predictable move, not so much for Soros. Soros, meanwhile, says Tirana, the capital of Albania, is my second home. Soros, whose father is Hungarian, kinda, reportedly travels to the capital of Tirana so often that he's called it my second home, despite the country being a hub for drug trafficking, human trafficking, and money laundering. Why'd they say despite? You know. It's not despite that, I don't think. To be fair, Soros' Open Society Foundation claims to be working with Albanian President Edi Rama on judicial reform, although locals scoff at the prospect. And between 1992 and 2020, the Open Society Foundation invested over $131 million in Albania, supporting Rama's rise to power and then his government. Rama has been almost unopposed in power since 2013. Open Society claims to support 120 countries around the world, baffling many who wonder why it spends so much money and time in Albania when, according to several reports, corruption has declined only slightly during Rama's regime. According to Transparency Org's Corruption Index, Albania is ranked as highly corrupt, with at least 25% of public officials receiving a bribe in the last year. According to the Organized Crime Index, Albania is a source, transit, and destination country for human trafficking. Albanian criminal actors are allegedly responsible for a large number of trafficking victims in Western Europe, especially in the UK, and a majority of women trafficked from Albania. Sexual exploitation of Albanian victims in Western European countries remains the most prevalent form of this crime. It's a transit company for heroin trafficked from Turkey, Iran, Afghanistan, and Pakistan through the Balkan route to Europe. Most heroin is trafficked into Albania by land through North Macedonia. Alexander Soros stays in Ivan Haksa's personal home. Sources in Albania tell me frequently on his many trips to Tirana, Soros prefers to stay in the former tyrannical dictator Ivan Haksa's personal home rather than a hotel. It's insane, a source told me. To Albanians, that's like going to Germany and staying in Hitler's eagle nest. Haksa was a Stalinist who out-Stalined Stalin, ruling with an iron fist for 41 years until his death in 1985. During that time, he made all personal property, including farm animals, land, and even bees, state property, and went so far as to remove all motors from cars and boats so people could not leave the country. It was referred to as Europe's North Korea. Thousands were imprisoned in harsh labor camps and tortured, while thousands more starved to death during his tenure, while Haksa and his cronies lived largely in Tirana. During Haksa's reign of terror, the economy tanked so much that up until the early 2000s, Albania was the second poorest country in the world, following Somalia. Why Alexander Soros likes to stay in Haksa's home, who knows, but it's not right, another Albanian told me. The sprawling homes in the middle of Tirana is a time capsule, as it is to be left in the exact state it was when Haksa died and is still fiercely guarded despite plans for it to be made into a museum. So how crazy is that? You've got Alexander Soros, son of George Soros, living in the museum-preserved mansion of the Stalinist dictator of Albania that ruled with an iron fist until his death in 1985. The Open Societies Foundation and Alexander Soros are good friends with the current president of Albania, who they bankrolled and helped fund and get into power all the way back in 2013. He also is apparently good friends with the Kushners and has been instrumental in getting the changes to the protected status of the wetlands in order to facilitate their building of this massive complex in the formerly militarized island off the coast there. A lot of, like, strange connections here. I wonder if we were to look up Haksa or, you know, Rama, if their family has any ties to perhaps some, you know, famous Zionist families elsewhere. But I think like that, you know, that's the real thing that's happening here. It really is just like they get to dictate the path the countries take, and they don't have a right to. They don't have the approval of the people in those countries. However, they have enough money from, you know, in the case of Soros, crashing the currency of England. And, you know, of course, he did that with Scott Bessent. Scott Bessent was the mind behind a lot of the methods by which George Soros has increased his wealth on the back of taxpayers around the world. And they get to take this money and bribe presidents and manipulate political systems and, you know, build these giant private resorts, and they just get to do it. They get to do it. And if Albania tries to stop them, I can pretty much guarantee you that diplomats in America are going to intervene and say, you know, Albania gets a lot of help from America. That help can go away if you don't, you know, help out our friends here. Of course, it doesn't benefit America at all. This isn't in America's interest, but people like Kushner and Soros use the power of America to progress their own, you know, personal agenda, even though, again, they're totally unelected and basically their participation in American politics has been relentlessly negative. Doesn't matter. They're the princes. They're the princes. And so they get to do whatever the hell they want. Michael Vachon, a rep for Soros, said in an email, Edi Rama, who has been a leader in efforts to build regional cooperation, enhancing freedom of movement and goods between and among Western and Western Balkan countries. Rama was one of the founders of Open Balkan and other initiatives such as the Growth Plan, which aimed to increase economic cooperation in the region, a goal supported by the Open Society Foundation. The foundation in Tirana, which has a proud three-decade legacy with contributions in education, democracy, and freedom of media, is in the fight against corruption. Albania has carried out the toughest judicial reforms in cooperation with the U.S. and EU Department of Justice. Let's just hope this justice reform in Albania is not like the one Soros spearheaded in the United States when ultra-liberal district attorneys took a soft-glove approach to criminals and crime soared. This election cycle, many were routed out of office by Americans fed up with their quality of life plummeting. Vikan said he didn't think Soros stay in Hox's home. He didn't think Soros stayed in Hox's home, but couldn't confirm. Not exactly surprising that there's a strange connection between the former communist dictator of Albania and George Soros, and that they would have direct connections to the Kushners, who, of course, themselves were like longtime family friends with the Netanyahus. And it's like, yeah, these are the families that run the world. They just do. I don't know what else to tell you. Like, they don't have a right to do it. They don't have justification for doing it, but they have the power to do it. So they do it. And that's it. Like, we're just letting them do it, I guess. Of course, Albania is trying not to let them do it. And again, I think they'll probably experience some backlash to that from the American government. And then let's go to this video, actually. I forgot to find which number it is. It's in the Israeli section, because Jared Kushner, again, no official position in the United States, as far as I know, or at least he's not supposed to have one. I guess he's like technically it's not ambassador, but, you know, diplomatic envoy or something like that. But of course, he wields inordinate power through this position and is, of course, planning on making billions of dollars through rebuilding Gaza and all that other stuff. Jared Kushner says countries that normalize with Israel through the Abraham Accords will be rewarded with investment money and political backing. He says new economic packages are being prepared to deepen normalization and pull more countries into the Accords, while highlighting Morocco as a model and Syria as a possible next target. Kushner openly frames alignment with Israel as a gateway to wealth, status, and foreign investment. So again, this is, I guess, technically a spokesperson for America using America's power and America's influence to get good deals for Israel. Let's watch.
And to promote the Abraham Accords to, you know, make the ones that are existing stick, and then also to find new opportunities. So I have a partner, my partner, Asher, who I mentioned before. He's actually of Moroccan descent and actually of Syrian descent. So we've been looking, maybe there's some opportunities to bring investment to Morocco, a country that I know you're very proud of, to really help them create dividends from the Abraham Accords. And so to show the people there that there can be great rewards, because leaders who join the Abraham Accords, it shows that they're thinking about the future. They're pushing for stability. It shows a lot of wisdom and a lot of forward thinking. So those are the environments where I think investors would want to be in. And I have a lot of, American investors who are very, who love the Abraham Accords, who want to join us in that. So we're looking at opportunities to invest in countries who have joined the Abraham Accords, but we're also looking at opportunities to invest in countries that might join the Abraham Accords and to create economic packages to incentivize them. So another one of my partners is Syrian, and he said, Jared, we should put together a big investment package, maybe for Syria, so that if they join the Abraham Accords, they could have a big incentive to do it. How amazing would it be to have, you know, a Muslim and Jewish firm working, Jewish partners, with American, working together to try to bring investment there. So something we're looking at. Obviously, there are some complications, but I think there's a ton of potential there. And if they were to join the Abraham Accords, I think that there's a lot of people who would want to invest there to help give them the best chance to achieve their full potential.
So as David Miller at tracking_power puts it, here's Jared Kushner spelling out how Pax Judaica will spread in West Asia and North Africa via the Abraham Accords. It will subjugate the whole region for the Jewish state and become a Jewish empire. The same process is happening in Latin America via their Isaac Accords. It's coming unless it's stopped. And yeah, again, you know, the Abraham Accords are not for America's benefit. It's basically an agreement to provide American money to countries that agree to normalize relations with Israel. Like, the Abraham Accords were the catalyst behind October 7th, right? Because there was this process of normalization going on, and basically they said, we'll normalize with Israel. Israel will normalize relationships with you, Saudi Arabia, UAE, Qatar, all these countries. You just have to drop the whole Palestinian freedom movement. So the Palestinians saw that process going on and thought, we better interrupt this. We have to stop this process from going forward, or else they're going to systematically basically take over every country in the region through economic incentives. And at the end of it, the Palestinians will be left without any allies, and the Israelis will be able to convert Al-Aqsa Mosque into a third temple and eradicate all of them once and for all. So that's what Al-Aqsa Flood, the attack on October 7th, was trying to stop, because they recognize the real purpose of the Abraham Accords, as Kushner does as well. Use American power to force countries to bend the will to Israel, and they'll expand as much as they can.
So it's real simple. If you want to keep this broadcast on the air, if you want to see us hire more hosts, more reporters, and expand, go to thealexjonesstore.com and get the very best supplements, wide selection of Patriot apparel, and so much cool stuff. The problem is the really cool products they get, like the Faraday bags and the wallets and the knives. It's all great. They sell out so quick and they can't get the supply of them. But I want to thank you all for your support. So they give away an amazing American super vehicle, usually an off-road truck or SUV or sports car, every month. But every month of the last week, there is a special time where every purchase you get gets put into the sweepstakes 100 times, every dollar you spend. And most winners do it during this last week. And then you get $10,000 per vehicle when you win it. Nobody's ever won two vehicles at once. It's over 12 vehicles that have been away now, or 14 vehicles. So this week until Friday at midnight, it's by law, it's all sweepstakes company. Every order you make, every dollar you spend at theauctionstore.com, you get put in 100X to win the souped-up custom H1 Hummer and the 2026 Dodge Charger Scat Pack, plus $20,000 cash, or $10,000 each if you just won one vehicle. I can't wait till somebody wins both. Every dollar spent, 100X entries at thealexjonesstore.com. And that's a bigly thing that, you know, they're our sponsor, main funder. I was never really a sweepstakes guy, but now I like it because listeners love it. And, you know, we fly the winners in. We're building a bigger studio. As soon as that's done, we'll have winners in again. So take action on that right now at thealexjonesstore.com. But let me just say this again. All I want to do is steer you right. I would not sell you something that doesn't work, because I want you to like me in the show, and I also want you to want to get it again. I use the analogy all the time. If I owned a restaurant, it would have real quality, delicious, wide selection, great atmosphere, great service, reasonable price. I want to have the restaurant that has lines around the block every time. I don't want to, you know, you don't need Google to know who's got a good restaurant. When you're even some small town middle of nowhere, I'll be driving along with family. Hey, let's search reviews. This town coming up. I go, I'm not looking at a review. Human intelligence. I'm going to pull into town and I'll drive through the town and say, okay, that place has 5 cars at it. That has 20. That has a line out the door. If I'm not in a big hurry, I'd rather go to the one with the line out the door. If I'm in a hurry, let's go to the one that's full at least. And then I get this incredible meal. You can buy fake Google reviews. I don't go off that. I go off the reality. And if you don't get our ultramethylene blue or ultramethylene red or Irish CMOS or Shilajit or a bovine colostrum or a T3 iodine is the best, you are insane. You're not just getting the very best products that'll blow you away. You're funding an organization proven to piss off tyrants and change the world for the better. Take action now at thealexjonesstore.com. There's a big mega sale one day going right now. 40% off Methylene Red, Atomic Defense Moon Booster, Methylene Blue Tincture, Methylene Blue Gummies, MK Ultra Brain Booster, Warcry Smelling Salts, 35% off Zeolite Detox, Spike Protein, Heavy Metal Detox, Zeolite Tincture, Creatine Powder, the very best, CMOS Capsules, Methylene Blue Caps, 30% off Iodine Tincture, CMOS Gummies, Trilogy Caps and Gummies, Ultimate Chill and Energy, and so much more. And that funds the second American Revolution worldwide. So you have until Friday at midnight central to get in to win either or both of the vehicles, 100 times entries, but that's just a fun thing you do. You're missing out if you don't get the incredible products. And by the way, I was like, what are smelling salts for? I was ignorant. They're like, oh, they're a best seller, sir. We're selling. It's a big seller now. I guess if you're going to lift weights or you want to wake up without coffee, just smell this. My God, you're awake. You're a truck driver or whatever, you know. Don't have to drink too much coffee or whatever. Just hit this. Warcry smelling salts. It's all there at thealexjonesstore.com.
Days, weeks, and even years ahead of the news cycle. AlexJonesLive.com is tomorrow's news today.
Folks, I think I got an answer to the question about Albania. Matt Baker, Credit to him. He just texted me. Did you know that Albania is the most homogenous and racially consistent country in Europe? Did you know that? Isn't that crazy? Isn't that nuts? Albania is one of the most ethnically homogenous countries in Europe, with ethnic Albanians making approximately 96 to 98% of the total population. So I think I figured out why Soros and Kushner have a sudden overwhelming urge to invest in Albania, to help them to open up their society. God, they're too closed. They're too white. We've got to fix that. We've got to fix that problem. I mean, we are here to offer you things. Actually, we're here to make your life better. Actually, we're going to invest in you. Certainly investments don't come along with gigantic cable-sized strings attached. Of course not. Let's talk about the Jews, shall we? Let's get into it. Let's talk about it, because it's not Israelis necessarily, but we are lucky enough to be privy to the Republican Jewish Coalition, where Representative Randy Fine has gone out of his way to thank the Republican Jewish Coalition for helping to remove Thomas Massie from the United States government with foreign funding. He says anyone that opposes Israel will be removed from the United States government. They deserve it. Let's go to clip number 12 here.
As we have shown, the evil that comes out of his mouth and the evil of so many like him. I served with two anti-Semites, Marjorie Taylor Greene and Thomas Massie. One we got to quit, and the other, thanks to all of you, we beat. And we're very, very lucky. Whereas Democrats 20 or 30 or 40 years ago had anti-Semitism show up in their party, and they minimized it, and they said it was the fringe, and they didn't deal with it, and it took over their party, the leader of our party said he wasn't going to deal with that. We often say that Donald J. Trump is the greatest friend that Israel's ever had, but that doesn't go far enough. Donald J. Trump is the greatest friend American Jews have ever had, because he stands up and he fights for all of us.
You had the CEO of the Republican Jewish Coalition reflect and you acknowledge the same reality, saying over the past few months, the Republican Jewish Coalition spent more than $5 million to defeat Thomas Massie. Again, probably the greatest Republican in office at this point, removed by the American Jews. Thanks, guys. Thanks a lot. Let's watch clip number 14 now.
Over the past few months, the RJC spent more than $5 million to defeat Thomas Massie. And let me say very clearly tonight that was a fight worth having and a victory worth celebrating. When someone repeatedly undermines support for Israel, traffics in isolationism at a moment of global danger, and refuses to stand with the Jewish state when it matters most, there has to be consequences.
Yes, overwhelming and inappropriate consequences for daring to moderately oppose our genocidal activity in the Middle East and paying for it also. There have to be consequences felt. Okay, so again, you know, it's kind of similar to like the war in Iran, where it's obvious that Israel is at fault. At the end of the day, everybody says it, right? Marco Rubio said it was Israel. Hegseth said it was Israel. Even Trump admitted it was Israel by accident. And then they turn around and go, you're an anti-Semite for saying that it's Israel. Well, we just saw Randy Fine at the Republican Jewish Coalition say that it was for opposing American Jews that Thomas Massie was ousted. The CEO of the Republican Jewish Coalition said that he needed to be made an example of, punished, suffer consequences for daring to oppose the Jews, which is interesting because before the election, or maybe this was shortly after the election, conservative thought leader Ben Shapiro, clip number 23, had this to say about Thomas Massie. Let's watch.
Not a surprise that Massey's friends are all of the most conspiratorial anti-Israel people on planet Earth. That would include Cenk Uygur, who put out a tweet, if Representative Thomas Massie loses tomorrow, the Republicans will become Israel's party. It's about Israel. By the way, it's not about Israel. I'll explain in a moment. Republicans will give them as much of our money as possible and go to war for them whenever they ask. Israel 100% control the GOP because every member will be scared to death of opposing them. Now, again, the reason why Massie is in hot water here has nothing to do with his stance with regard to Israel. It has everything to do with his stance with regard to conspiratorial nonsense about Jeffrey Epstein and the fact that he has voted against a wide variety of President Trump's priorities in Congress. He's sort of a Ron Paul figure who votes against large priorities of the Republican Party, which has ticked off President Trump pretty extraordinarily. Massie is trying this dumb routine. Massie himself is out there saying that Israel is trying to buy his seat in Congress. Again, my dude. Like this tactic is one of the dumbest tactics. I just have to say, it's such an incredibly... It's a tactic made for stupid people.
Oh, you're so stupid.
And the reality is that people who are pro-Israel do not like Thomas Massie because Thomas Massie has engaged in every conspiracy theory it is possible to engage in and has made common cause with the most anti-Israel people. That's true. But the reason that Thomas Massie is actually in trouble is because the Trump administration has decided to oppose him on the basis of completely other issues. And so the usual game that is now played right now on the right, in the very podcast-istan right, the game that is played is there will be a critique that has nothing to do with Israel.
Nothing
and the first thing you do
it.
Is you claim that it's about Israel.
Yeah.
In an attempt to gin up the crazier part of the Republican base.
See, if you think Thomas Massie was ousted over his views of Israel, if he was ousted by the Jews, you're an idiot. You're so stupid. I can't believe how stupid you are to think that that's actually true. You idiot. I mean, what else is there to say? What more is there to say, folks? Could you ever trust Ben Shapiro ever again? Did you trust him in the first place? You know, it's just, it was as obvious then as it is now, but it's nice. It's nice to see the Republican Jewish Coalition, you know, come out and celebrate and admit that yes, it was because of Thomas Massie's opposition to Israel that American Jews poured money into defeating him. Yeah, we know. No, we're aware, and we're aware that Ben Shapiro is also aware of that and is lying to cover it up because he's not motivated by the truth. He's not motivated by what's best for America. He's motivated by ethnic supremacy, just like John Podoretz, who, of course, celebrated the role that Jewish money played in defeating Representative Thomas Massie. Let's watch this absolute freak.
It's a good thing if Massie and the people like him and others believe that if you cross the line into anti-Semitism, Jews are going to use the power that we have openly to go for you. Because what other recourse is there? Are we just going to sit here and take it, beg for scraps, hope that nice people are nice to us? The Democratic Party is going explicitly anti-Semitic. We can see it happening. People are getting benefits, as Seth says, for being anti-Semites. That seems to be part of an appeal in primaries to the left and the party. We have to use what means there are at our disposal. And in my view, and I'm going to put it blank, that is Jewish money. There is an enormous amount of Jewish money in politics, by which I mean Jewish donors, wildly disproportionate, not only charitably, but politically. When I say charitably, I mean nobody really knows the numbers. Jews make up 2% of the population. According to some studies, Jews make up 20% of the charitable contributions made in the United States annually. That is a tenfold. Think about that. Think about the disproportion of that. And in politics, it's pretty close also. And if that money isn't used, what? Why do people give money? Because they want to influence elections to get people elected who reflect their views. Well, this is an existential issue for Jews. And the Jews who explicitly give money because they want to make it clear to anti-Semitic candidates that they are going to have to go through a buzzsaw and that they are not going to simply waltz in and be, if they're treated with kid gloves by the New York Times, we are double time going to do what we can to expose who they are, to find out what we can find out about them that will harm them, and that we will do what we can to prevent them from taking office. What other choice does American Jewry have?
You can not do any of that. The other choice is to not be corrupt tyrants, I think would be the other option. Of course, then you would have to not kill a bunch of Palestinian children. So that's sort of incompatible, unfortunately, for you. Do you remember we talked about the doctrine of severity? Do you remember from the protocols of the elders of Zion, the doctrine of severity? That it doesn't matter that Thomas Massie's not actually an anti-Semite. You have to let these people know. You have to let the politicians know. They have to be 100% on board with the globalist scheme, or they will be destroyed. Okay, and they'll brag about it, right? It's the doctrine of severity, and it's very effective. And look, they really are getting way too comfortable with this stuff. Let's go to this video from Chris Menahan at InfoLib News, one of the best sources for these videos. This is Israeli ambassador to the UN, Donnie Dannon, saying, I hope cameras don't record this, which is weird because he's on a stage. It's kind of ironic. But he says, not clip 21, is this one here. Israeli ambassador to the UN, Dannon, I don't know how you say his name. He says, I was shocked. I told him, what are you talking about? He's talking about Tucker Carlson. So again, this is weird. It's like, he's like, I hope I'm not being filmed. He's literally on a stage. But here is Israeli ambassador to the UN talking about how Jews need to be making lists of enemies. Let's watch.
And if I may, I want to share a story. I hope the cameras will not record it. But I got a phone call during the war from Tucker Carlson. He called me and he told me, Ambassador, can you please take me off the list? And I was shocked. I told him, what are you talking about? He told me, I'm being attacked by the Jews. So maybe you have like a list. Can you take me off the list? So I waited for a minute and I told him, Mr. Carlson, we don't have a list. You are being attacked because you're spreading lies, blood libels against our soldiers. My son was in Gaza when he called me that day. I told him, you're spreading anti-Semitism. You're hosting anti-Semites. So you're being attacked. But you know, when we finished the call, I thought to myself, Norm, maybe we should have a list. Maybe it's about time we put a list of those who promote anti-Semitism online, of those who are hosting anti-Semites on podcasts, and fight back. And I think we have to do it because it's not going anywhere. It's going to be with us, and it's brutal, it's a war, and we have to stand up and fight it.
And we can make lists too. We can all make lists. Wouldn't that be fun? The weird thing is, this was the same thing that Huckabee said to Netanyahu. Y'all remember when they made that creepy video where I thought Netanyahu was dead, and it's him and Mike Huckabee, and it's Huckabee being like, I hope I'm not on your kill list. And he's like, you're on the good list, buddy. It's like, yeah, no, it's very funny. The group of people who most often utilize targeted killings in their foreign policy or in their public relations or in their everyday life, just joking about killing American media stars for daring to oppose them. The ambassador to the UN making these funny, lighthearted comments about how they're going to create a kill list to murder Tucker Carlson, American journalist, for daring to point out the inhumane, vicious, genocidal behavior of Israel in Gaza. It's very funny. It's very funny when they say things like that. Let's go to clip number 22 here, because since we're talking about Tucker, Tucker was being interviewed by a woman, and they got onto the topic of Gaza. And, of course, Tucker Carlson's exactly right. And this is the problem that Israel is running up against. This is the problem the Jews are running up against, is that their positions are in favor of genocide, and the cover-up's not working out anymore. And so it's not like you can go, well, I think it's genocide, but you think it's self-protection. Everybody thinks it's genocide. You're just in favor of it. And that's not a great look, guys. So here's Tucker Carlson basically laughing at this woman for trying to defend what's going on in Gaza. Let's watch.
What do you think of Gaza?
What do I think of Gaza?
Yeah.
I think the war in Gaza, to start with, was a perfectly reasonable response in response to the horrors of October 7th. I think now the places. I mean, I've been there. Have you been to Gaza? I've been to Gaza since the war started.
They would not it's let catastrophic. Me into Gaza. Trust me. Very few 70, journalists get into 000. Gaza.
Yeah, no, I went with the IDF. It's the only way that you can go in. But nonetheless, you go in no and you see a flattened place. I think it is a disaster for the future of Israel, a disaster for the Palestinian people, a horror, 70,000 people dead.
Why would you describe it first as a disaster for the future of Israel? You've got tens of thousands of civilians murdered, but it's foremost a disaster for the future of Israel? No, it's foremost a disaster for the families of the dead kids.
Absolutely, I made 3 points.
Because everybody sucks up to Israel in this way that suggests they're afraid. And everyone is afraid, and you know that. Everyone's like, the real problem is calling people anti-Semites allows real anti-Semites to flourish. It's like, okay, no, actually, the real problem with calling people anti-Semites who aren't is accusing the innocent of a crime they didn't commit. And the real crime in Gaza is killing people who did nothing wrong. So those are the real problems, I would say. But no one can say it because you have to be like, oh, no, but really, October 7th
I don't know what you're talking about, Gaza. We're having a...
Everyone watching this knows what I'm talking about.
Well, let's get on to that right now.
Yeah.
Because you...
Everyone watching knows what I'm talking about. Yeah, we do. No, we get it. And she gets it too. I mean, she knows exactly what he's talking about. And it's really, it's not working anymore. Long story short, it's just not working anymore. And, you know, this is what we need. We need global mass opposition to Israel at every pass. That's the only thing that's going to solve this. Like, they should be kicked out of Eurovision. They should be kicked out of the World Cup. They should not, their people should not be welcomed anywhere as tourists. I mean, as individuals, we got to like stand up against this. And as a collective, we have to stand up against it. And it is happening. And the Israelis are being humiliated absolutely everywhere. They don't care though, because they have power and they're just going to continue to do whatever the hell they want until you stop them. But it is good to see these people just getting smacked down right to their faces. Let's go to this. Israeli diplomat Waleed Gadban got humiliated and silenced at the UN in Geneva. So this is a meeting about labor unions, I suppose. This one here from Parody Jeff. Israeli diplomat Waleed Gadban humiliated and silenced at the UN in Geneva. Couldn't even finish his speech as people shut him down completely. Jews are melting down because the world is done listening to their lies, it says. Clip number 10 here. Let's watch. So those are the fellow UN diplomats stomping their feet and banging their desks to stop the Israeli representative from talking.
By deciding that we adopt the decision regardless, the procedure was infected. Undone in a way that should not be impeached.
Yeah, so again, I'm completely in favor of this. Just drown them out. Just bang on the table, drown them out. I mean, they're just lying. They're just full of crap. I mean, even when they're not lying, even when, like, they're kind of telling the truth, it's still ridiculous what they're saying. Like, it's... clip 23 here, or 21 rather. This is Israel's ambassador in the UN, complaining that Hezbollah is using drones to fight their soldiers. It's like, these freaking people, they literally think it should be illegal to oppose them. They literally think they should be able to go into your country with tanks and missiles and planes and take over your country. And if you dare to oppose them, they claim it's illegal and will try to stop you through the UN. And it's just like, shut up. Shut the hell up. Let's watch.
This is an example of a drone used by Hezbollah. This is what we are dealing with.
What we are dealing with.
Now, Hezbollah are using different kinds of drones.
Oh, my gosh. You poor babies.
Use them with fiber optic.
Oh, my God. Not fiber
These drones
optics.
Weigh less than 2 kilograms.
Oh, they're not allowed
it
to do that.
Low. It is very difficult to detect.
Oh, my God. Well, they should let you detect it.
You hear it above your head. It's too late.
Well, good. You deserve it. Whatever. We can take it down. I mean, literally that. I mean, like, who does that? They are literally murdering thousands of people in Lebanon. Their official policy is for every one Hezbollah drone, they're going to destroy 10 buildings,
kill 100 people. They are rolling in there with advanced tanks. They are bombing Lebanon with jet fighters and, you know, missile launches from 1,000 miles away. And then they go to the UN and they say, look, these regular people in Lebanon, the militia, the civilian militia in Lebanon is using drones to attack us. They shouldn't be allowed to do that. How dare they? Completely. They literally think they should be able to kill you with impunity and that you fighting back is the bad thing. It's anti-Semitic. Basically, if you're Hezbollah and you're using drones, it's anti-Semitic. Or if you're an American and you want your politician to represent you, it's anti-Semitic. It's anti-Semitic to oppose the Jews in any possible way. The Albanians, give your country over. The Lebanese, give your country over. Americans, give your country over. Otherwise, you are trying to do another Holocaust and you will be put on the list. Okay? Glad we have that understood clearly. Thanks, Jews. We do have some good news here. We have some interesting breaking news. The House has voted to rebuke Trump over the war in Iran. The House of Representatives offered a rare rebuke to President Trump on Wednesday, passing a Democrat-led measure to end his war in Iran over objections from Republican leadership. It was one of two Democrat-led measures opposed by the White House that advanced in the GOP-led House. Lawmakers passed a motion that would unlock a vote on sending aid to Ukraine. The Iran War Powers Resolution, offered by Representative Meeks of New York, the top Democrat on the Foreign Affairs Committee, has been headed for a vote before the House left for its Memorial Day recess May 21st, but it was abruptly pulled from the floor when it appeared too many Republicans were absent to defeat it. On Wednesday, it passed 215 to 208, with four Republicans joining the Democrats in voting yes, including Thomas Massey, Tom Barrett of Michigan, Brian Fitzpatrick, and Warren Davidson of Ohio. The resolution directs Trump to remove U.S. armed forces from hostilities with Iran unless Congress votes to declare war or authorizes using military force against it. It would not force him to end the conflict, however. It is a symbolic expression of disapproval of the war with Iran. But remember, when it comes to what Israel wants, the rules don't matter. The laws don't apply, okay? There is a 60-day period in which the president can, you know, carry out military operations before it has to be put to a vote. That 90-day window passed, or 60-day window passed a month or more ago, and yet it continues. It doesn't matter, right? Like, Israel wants it, so it's happening. The laws of the Constitution, be damned. The rules of procedure in Congress, who cares? They're doing it, they're getting it done, and there's no legal precedent or predicate that will stop them, okay? But it's good this is happening. We can go to clip number 16 here. Al Jazeera confirms a massive Pentagon disaster. Let's watch.
Let's bring in Almigdad Al-Ruhayd, who joins us from the Iranian capital, Tehran. Almigdad, how is this latest exchange being framed in Iran?
Well, actually, fully, this another chapter in a pattern of reaction, of action and reaction between United States and the Iranian here, especially in the front of the Strait of Hormuz and Fish Island and the cities overlooking to the Strait of Hormuz, has been unfolding over the past 2 weeks, actually. The story from here is being framed as a response for the attacks of from the United States, what they call the United States aggression on Iranian oil tanker. After that, a renewed attack on IRGC communication facilities in Qishm Island in southern of Iran. And in response to that, the IRGC stated clearly that they attacked the United States 5th Fleet in the region and also the base to helicopters in the region. So
again, our bases have been destroyed. The war was lost as soon as it began. We are in a worse position now in terms of nuclear development or the Strait of Hormuz. Both cases were better before the war started. It's time to end it. It's time for Congress to end it.
These new data centers will oversee everyone in the galaxy. I will be in full control.
Power levels are stable. Proceed with the install. Copy that. Installing the module now. Connection confirmed. All green.
Cable secured. Power to the cluster. Initiating boot sequence. Component locked. Running diagnostics. Archive systems online. Report to command.
Instruction team, report status. Power grid stable. TK-421. Cabling complete. No faults. Proceed to phase two for the Empire.
Things are going according to plan. The Emperor will be happy. The Empire demands perfection.
Status report. Any anomalies?
Diagnostics are clear, sir.
Proceed with the calibration. Watch for fluctuations.
I find your desire for privacy insignificant. The Empire's new data network will observe every corner of the galaxy, every signal, every act of disloyalty.
A disturbance in the Force there is. Feel it, you can.
Those who obey have nothing to fear. Those who resist will be terminated.
Ahead of the news cycle, AlexJonesLive.com is tomorrow's news today.